morning. I'd like to call this meeting to order. It's the City of Palm Coast City Council Workshop. It is Tuesday, March 10th, 2020. It is 9 a.m. Please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Roll call, please.
Mayor Holland.
Here.
Vice Mayor Sleuthis.
Present.
Councilmember Branquino.
Here.
Councilmember Cuff.
Present.
Councilmember Howe.
Here.
All members are present.
Thank you. Now, open up to public participation. Any member of the public wishes to make public comments. You have up to 3 minutes. Please state your name for the record. Your 3 minutes will begin. Seeing none, I'll close public comment. I'll take it back to agenda item number E is presentations. Presentations for parks and recreation and tax.
Thank you, all members of the council. We have Lauren Johnson and Carl Cody here to present the status and our outlook of the recreation parks impact fee.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, good morning, Mayor and Council. We are here to present on the Park and Rec impact fee update. Just a little bit of background, this impact fee is to provide a basis for parks and recreation services. Fees are used to pay for growth-related parks and recreation facilities, and fees are typically paid by new residential development that has increased with demand. Our current rate is $849.24, and that includes a $575 discount. And the fee was last reviewed in 2014. A timeline from what we've completed, back in January 14th, we came to you with the impact fee study results, along with our consultant. On January 30th, we held a public outreach meeting at the Palm Coast Community Center. On February 18th, we met with the Home Builders Association. We're here today to discuss the public feedback and determine a 90-day grace period for adoption, and then propose an adoption of the fee ordinance on meetings March 17th and April 7th. Our Parks Master Plan was created back in 2008, and it's a comprehensive plan that reviews all of parks facilities for the next 30 years. The vision for parks and recreation facilities is community growth. To implement the vision, a series of criteria were developed to guide the development and management of the park system. Back in our presentation in January, we showed you the completed projects that we've done since 2008 of the master plan, which those include Ralph Carter Park, Palm Harbor Golf Course, Belterre Park, Waterfront Park, Long Creek Nature Preserve Phase 1. We expanded Indian Trail Sports Complex several times. We had completed Holland Park Phase 1 expansion. We added sunshade sales to several of our facilities. We renovated and expanded the Palm Coast Community Center. We expanded our multi-use path system. We acquired the Hidden Lakes Park and also the Town Center Pocket Park. This is a list of eligible major projects for impact fee funding. And all of these are unfunded and were outlined in the Parks Master Plan.
One question about, I don't mean to interrupt your presentation, but the L section kayak launch is not a developer obligation. I was under the impression that was part of what was being provided as part of the master plan for that. I mean, it's a relatively minor item, and I don't recall
if they got park impact fee credits for doing that. There was it was part of the development.
That was negotiations.
I just don't recall if they got park impact fee credits. You can check on that.
Yeah.
So just some public feedback from our outreach meetings. There were 38 residents in attendance at the meeting at the Palm Coast Community Center. The meeting was facilitated by Parks and Recreation, Community Development, Finance, and Stormwater and Engineering. We invited groups such as the Sports Alliance, Palm Coast Arts Foundation, Friends of Tennis. Most of the concerns were on current projects and what we were going to do programming-wise inside of those parks, and potential funding opportunities such as corporate sponsorship. Pickleball was a very big topic. We had a large pickleball group at the meeting, as well as disc golf, sport field allocation, and sport lighting. We hosted the Home Builders Association, and they had questions such as the formula for calculating the impact fees. They had asked about using countywide facilities, including that in our impact fee calculating, shortening the planning period. They also had questions about the impacts of housing affordability and marketability, our level of service, and the master plan project listing. We're here today to propose council action, adopt the proposed Parks and Recreation impact fee that was outlined in the January 14th meeting, and approve the ordinance on March 17th with the items that will include the use of impact fees for future dates, include an annual adjustment on the construction cost index, review every 5 years as major changes occur, and establish a 90-day grace period from adoption.
Any questions at this time?
You had mentioned on one of the first slides that there was a discount currently given. Can you just explain that a little bit more?
Do we want to have Henry come in and explain
We have a rate consultant here today, too, that can go through the history, because he was involved in the last impact fee study for Park and Recs.
Good morning.
Morning.
Henry Thomas with Raftalis. As I heard the question from the back, the question was the basis for the credit in the last impact fee. So we did not do the prior study to the last one. I believe then the fee was about $1,250. When we developed the impact fee the last time, it actually demonstrated the need for an increase. However, in working with the developers and working with the city manager, there was a decision made that we should discount it, primarily because at that point in time, there was an emphasis on the funding of the plan that was not impact fee related, coming from property taxes. And I think that that was probably unrealistic at the time to be able to afford those facilities based on property tax levies. So this time through, as the staff developed the plan, the proposal is that as your sales tax monies free up, that we would look to the funding sources outside of the property tax realm to help fund that. So one of the basis or arguments for the discount initially was a new homeowner then also becomes a taxpayer. So if in the future they were paying higher taxes to pay for facilities, there was the potential for the for there to be a double count, if you will, or double charge. I'm paying an impact fee plus I'm paying the non-impact fee portion through my property taxes. So that was the basis for the fee discount at that time.
And I think it's important to talk about the one-time impact, right? That future growth invests into our infrastructure, whether it be Parks and Rec or stormwater projects like that. However, there is that ongoing maintenance cost, and so our residents do utilize, frankly, our amenities rather heavily, and when we talk about the one-time cost, I want to make sure also that we're not missing the mark on the ongoing costs, and I think that balances out with the ad valorem taxes because that comes out of operations. So if you couple with our sales tax collection, our revenue there, hopefully the you know, Be Local, Buy Local campaign really advances and increases the collection of our revenue there. That advances the projects that we've outlined for that one-time impact of the large amount of cost of actually adding amenities to our city, and then the ongoing cost overall to our residents comes out of operations. So I think that's important to note to the residents that it's very expensive to maintain the Indian Trail Sports Complex. It's not an inexpensive operation. So I think having it balanced out like this really addresses the issue of the capital costs initially, how we add amenities to our community as we grow, and then we balance that with the growth with the ongoing costs in our budget annually.
Yes, and clearly future projects will have that same impact. For example, aquatic centers, they're not cheap to operate either. So, but I will say this, that the fee basis that we proposed is what we believe is valid, and that you can adopt it and feel comfortable that it's a valid fee. Some communities do elect to still apply a discount, even if it wasn't developed the way we did last time, or alternatively phase in the fees over time a little bit when there's large increases. But that's a prerogative, a policy prerogative on your part. What I've done is calculated what I believe is the valid fee.
Okay. Council, any other questions or comments? I appreciate the presentation. Thank you for being here. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Ron. Next on our agenda is agenda item number E2, a presentation on the National Community Survey results for 2019.
Thank you. So we have Denise and Tyler to present, but as an overview, the city does a National Citizen Survey every other year, so a two-year benchmark, and it's very important. One, it helps us understand how effective the council's goals, policies, the strategic action plan items that you as a council prioritize, how well staff is executing on those, and how well we're performing. And so what we want to do today is kind of cover the initial citizen survey and share some of the statistics. I think we've picked out one or two or three, valid indicators today to kind of overview. We plan on coming back in more detail because, again, I think it's important that the community sees that the policies that council has chosen to enact, your guys' goals and vision for this community, are achieving the results that this community has asked for. And that's what's great about validating this through the survey. So with that, I'd like to ask Carlin, Tyler and Denise to present.
Good morning, Mayor and City Council. So thank you, Mr. Morton, for that great introduction. We're excited about the results. We do have some major updates to share, but let's first talk about the survey. So thinking of the strategic action plan, as Mr. Morton noted, and our budget process, this gives us the opportunity to get citizen opinion through a process that monitors the pulse of the community and also gives us a tool to look at how we're doing, what's the satisfaction of our citizens in different areas. So one of the ways that we use that is tracking trends. So we've been doing this style of survey since 2002, but in 2015, we did go, through council's direction to stagger that with a homegrown survey. And you'll see some of those trends today. Also, as we work through the strategic action plan evaluation process, revisit your priorities, we start talking about allocating resources and start having that conversation about budget. And overall, of course, this is a great opportunity to learn more of where we can improve our services. So this is a survey focus: community engagement, education and enrichment, economy, safety, built environment, natural environment, recreational wellness, and mobility. So this instrument is standardized. So not only are we looking at our community, but also benchmarking ourselves with 600 other communities across the nation. That's why that standardized format is very important. For the city of Palm Coast, there's 24 other Florida cities that participate in this year's survey.
So what do you mean by mobility? I'm just curious.
So within the actual survey, that specifically is a term used by the National Research Center. So these categories are drafted through their organization of surveying. Mobility is about public transportation, ease of getting across town, things of that nature. That's what we're looking at from how this is standardized.
So, you know, it's always interesting to me because when we do compare ourselves to other communities, transportation is the one that I struggle with the most due to the fact that to have a fixed route transportation system, A, is not economical. It's not economically feasible for Palm Coast the way it was designed and built out. And we don't have the population that would support that. That's why Volusia County is a little different. It's a little more dense, has a greater population, and has the capability of having a transit system. But they lose money every year, but they do have a transit system. So to set that expectation out to our community, you know, I'm not sure, you know, that's ever going to make sense. I know that the county is looking at another phase in their transportation system. So I just want to be cautious and careful when we move forward with these. And sometimes, you know, what is the actual feasibility of, you know, advancing a transportation network in the city of Palm Coast? Now, it could be connectivity, as you said. It could be, you know, adding to our trail network. Those are things that I think make sense, but when you're communicating that to the resident in a survey, if I was taking a survey and I could say, well, I have a great transportation system in the city of Palm Coast, I mean, frankly, how would I do that, you know? So I think moving forward, we probably want to have a clear conversation and understanding about that.
You raise a really interesting point, increasing the mobility figure here for our trail system. I was doing some Googling, and I was trying to find out how we can advocate to try to get the electric lead bicycles for our different trailheads, because I see a lot of people out there with the electric bikes, electric scooters, especially when I travel around, not necessarily Palm Coast, but that's one avenue that perhaps we can increase mobility without trying to implement something that is just not economically feasible, like a fixed route bus system.
So we'll start digging into the data. 1,700 residents received the actual mailing postage. They had the option of completing the survey online. This was randomly selected. That's part of the basis to the mechanics behind this survey. So randomly selected households across the city. And about 4% of those came back to the postage service, back to us. Because they were either vacant or just returned to sender outcomes. But we did have a total of 417 respondents. That is considered a amount that can be looked at analytically through statistics and weighted based on our demographics. So I know that number sounds small. Last time we did the survey in 2017, we had 444. That generally were around that same number. And so the demographics, you can see here some of the takeaway information, just a sample of who completed the survey, and again, in a weighted outcome. 55 years and older, 56%. Also, children 17 or up or under in household, 24%. And 81% owned their home. So of the items that we can compare when we do this survey, there's 133 of those. 96 items were rated similarly from 2017 and 2019. 34 increased, which is powerful in my opinion. Over half of those is in governance. So through your direction as city council, through your priorities, we are seeing those numbers climb. And we only saw 3 decrease, and to your point, Mayor, one of those was the transportation element. So we're going to start with some highlights, and then we're actually going to go further down into the detail of the elements that we compare, and also have staff come up and talk about some projects that are supporting your priorities in those areas. So just to start, quality of life. We're an excellent or great place to live. Reason it's framed that way is that we combine the numbers from the positive areas of the survey. So 86% think this is a great place to live. That went up 7%. They feel that they're safe in their neighborhoods. 95%, that's up by 5%. And a good place to raise children, 74%.
Why is that so low?
What?
The good place to raise children?
Yeah.
So again, this is a reflection of the pulse of the community. So in essence, it's really what our citizens are telling us, without assuming anything of what they were thinking when they completed it. These are the numbers behind the outcome of the survey.
Do you think that transportation might have an aspect to this? Because, for example, we're so spread out, and I've taught high school in various cities in the United States, and all of those infrastructures had public transportation, so kids could get to events. But here, you're so wide and this portionate number of people can't get over to the Indian trails, or they can't get to some of these other events. And then again, you know, what goes on after school? What activities are for the kids so that they're not just hanging out on the street looking to get into trouble? And so do we have enough of those activities for these kids to engage, you know? And that's an issue. Because I remember a few years ago, I had a young man, and it shocked me, it really did. He was an Eagle Scout, and he was hanging out with a couple of kids, and we put him in our program only to find out this kid was a bandit. They were just hanging out on the street, breaking into garages and things of that nature just for sport, because they had nothing else to do. And that figure really is upsetting, because if this is a great place to live, and everybody feels safe in their neighborhood, well then, you'd think that that would raise the bar on this is a good place to raise children. Because we do have a lot of kids now, but maybe it's because we were a senior community at one point, and everything was focused on senior living. I don't know, but I'd sure as heck like to see what we could do to bump those numbers up.
I feel like that's not the worst figure in the world, to be honest, from my like first glance at it, but I also wonder if it's the demographics of the 417 respondents, if they're a little bit older and they don't actually have children in our community right now.
The first two numbers could very easily be senior citizens that think it's great because it's safe and there's stuff for them to do and it's a nice environment. The lower, slightly lower, reflect a lot of things. I mean, transportation certainly could be one of them, but in my experience, very few kids in the suburbs these days take public transportation. Their parents drive them everywhere. They're old enough to drive themselves.
Yeah.
And it's,
in the city, it's a different story. Yeah. These kids, they have it mastered.
Yeah. You guys understand, 46% of the people said this place on coast is not a good place to raise your children. I don't believe it.
I don't believe it either.
Palm Coast is a great place to
raise your children.
Those are the 26%, in my opinion, that are a little disgruntled with something.
So we're going to figure out, what's going
on. I would raise my children here any day.
Yeah.
Where I came from, forget about it.
Oh, yeah. Right.
So, therefore, quality of life is still...
It just amazed me, because when I was teaching in New York City, I was out in Staten Island, I had kids coming in from Spanish Harlem that came all the way down to go to Staten Island, and these kids were wired with the infrastructure of transportation. That just shocked me, that's all, because I agree with you. This is a good place to raise your kids.
So air quality, 89%, up 2%. Overall cleanliness in community, up 1%, 84%. And paths and walking trails, 9% increase. We'll talk a little bit more about those areas as we move forward. City services, a big climb, a 15% increase, 75%. Customer service, 9% up to a 78%. And emergency preparedness, 9% increase to 81%.
No, I would also say I think our communications department is important in this because we are doing a lot of unbelievable initiatives that frankly do help the narrative for our residents to understand. First responders, we have an unbelievable fire department in our city, and you know, I certainly enjoy getting updates from them that I would not normally do. So I think that's changed a little bit. So the timing of that is important, and I hope to see more and more communication in the future for our residents, again, to truly understand where the trails are happening, where the streetlights are happening, why the streetlights have been delayed. Those sorts of things are important, and they matter to our residents.
Absolutely, and I am actually meeting with most departments this week to kind of talk about that story that they want to tell going forward. I know we talked about briefly the new website, and I don't know if I want to get into that here, but the replacement basically for Week in Review, and I think that'll be a great opportunity and platform for each department to tell the story that they want to highlight going forward.
Yeah, our residents don't know what they don't know, you know, and unless we're sharing that with them, I just, you know, that's got to be part of how we also make that investment. Again, not just spend the dollars doing it, but actually now relaying that to the residents, because in these surveys, they're telling us what's important to them.
And I think you're right, you know, with Palm Coast Connects now, relatively new, it enhances the citizens' knowledge of what's going on and their ability to impact their needs to the city government here. And on the other slide that you had before, you know, the government service was still in the 70s. Now, I think as this connects things, expands, and everybody gets used to it, and then they see how rapidly their questions are responded to, that will raise those numbers. It should.
Here, I see 89% overall appearance, 76% overall image. Is there a different question? Because appearance and image, for me, it seems like the same thing.
It's a separate question. It has a lot to do with one's governance, one's an impression from how we influence the appearance, cleanliness, things of that nature. They're grouped in the survey. So they are different. That is a different number. And overall appearance, just to get into this slide deeper, 89%, you see the yellow arrow up. That's reflecting that we're higher than the benchmark. So there's 600 other communities on the average were higher than our competitors within the survey. 76% overall image, neighborhoods, what the satisfaction of people living in their neighborhoods and what they think about their neighborhoods, 87%. A lot of this is a little redundant, but we wanted to make sure we package these well to talk about them. Overall quality of life, 82%, and place to retire, 87%. A little bit of a reflection on our previous discussion there. And we're higher than the benchmark in that area as well, and place to live, 86%.
87% place to retire.
I'll
tell you what, if I have to move out of this town, I'll move to Palm Coast. That's how much I still like this town, okay?
You know, I know this is just the annual one and we do it every other year, excuse me. But conferences that I attend, they have the audience participation, you know, on your phone, and then they up on the screen sort of talk about the results. Do we ever think about this as an ongoing process, like when we do lunch and learns, like when we're out with communities, organizations, Citizens Academy, the residents that are now really engaged and participating and do get the whole scope of what we're doing? I think it'd be interesting to see if we start this is sort of like a more fluid exercise where it's ongoing. And I don't know how much it would
be to actually have the survey equipment that we own, but to actually take it out in the community, I think would be, it would continue to keep us, you know, with the pulse of the community to say, you know, are we missing the mark on some of these things? You know, do we need to address one of the areas?
Well, I take your point, Mayor. I think, to me, a truly statistically randomized survey gives us a much better idea of what we really need to work on. I mean, the last Citizens Academy class that I spoke with just loved Palm Coast for the most part. At least I didn't hear any discouraging words from the back of the room. So, I mean, the folks that are engaged are either going to, I would say, love it or hate it, depending on what they're engaged about. But, and I mean, that's valuable if you can do it on a ongoing basis. But I do think we need to get, I think we need to be a little skeptical of, we love it, we hate it, if we're, you know, if we're drawing those kinds of responses from a,
I think it just opens up to a broader audience, not just the 414 people that are taking the survey, but rather, you know, now exposing more residents to these questions, it allows us to maybe open up a little bit more.
It's also a validation mechanism. If we segment out the results from the anonymous statistics here versus the statistics of the people who go through these type of programs, if they score higher, then we know what we're doing in those programs is the right thing because we're moving these numbers in the correct direction.
Was there any comparison between our city and surrounded cities that have about the same amount of people that we do?
22% from the South Atlantic participated. About 20, roughly 20% had roughly the same population as us.
Yeah, but my question is, how do we fare?
Well, it doesn't get into that level of detail of how we compare to DeLand or how we compare to specific communities. It's a large lump sum. It doesn't delineate out to that extent of, okay, in 100,000 population, you compare to this. It doesn't go to that detail. So we have some graphs here. You'll see the trends from 2013, 14, 15. This is where we started scattering 2017 and 2019. You'll start seeing these, I call them elbows, where we went down and now we're going up. And so pass and walking trails, 83%. We're above the benchmark on that. Ease of walking, 70%. 65% travel by bicycle and 57% sidewalk maintenance. And I'd like to welcome Matt to the forefront because we want to talk a little bit about what we're doing to improve those numbers.
Good morning, Mayor, Council. So Denise asked us to provide some pictures, and never wanted to turn down an opportunity to brag on my folks. We had to sift through quite a few in this area, but within Public Works, we have the Special Projects team, which takes on a lot of this work themselves, as well as the landscape professionals that do the line of sight work and the landscaping that you see on the bump outs here. So this project in particular on the left was the Sesame Boulevard expansion, about 3 miles of trails expansion. So that's an example of expanding amenities for our citizens. Another thing that we take on is the preservation of those amenities. So as we put in more pathways, that means we need to inspect and maintain and keep the amenities in great shape. So the more that we have, obviously, the more the time we spend inspecting and repairing. So what you don't see here is we've also taken steps towards some smaller equipment that we can do immediate smaller repairs, such as when there's cracks or lifts in the sidewalks that form tripping hazards. So this past year we purchased some equipment that allows us to go out and grind down those areas instead of having to replace an entire section we can repair it. So, but we do.
I think that is really what is important. You know, another example of Palms Coast Connect is our residents can be out on the trails. They can snap a photo of the crack. We know where it is, so our teams don't have to be out there assessing every trail every day. Our residents are actually helping us, notify us, and if it could be a quick repair, then you can assess it to maybe send your crews out there.
Yes, ma'am. That, you know, we talk about that all the time, and our citizens are sensors for us, so it allows us to get after a lot of the issues that, you know, we may not have noticed ourselves. They definitely have a means now to let us know quickly, and we can get after the repair. So
I have a question about the trails themselves. Now that I'm out there quite often with the mayor's 9090, I noticed there's a smaller subset of trails, and then there's a wider subset of trails. I'm assuming that a council at one time had made the determination that the trails need to be wider or the paths. Do you know, does anyone know the history of that?
So I don't have the history on that. I do know that the trails that we install now are the wider paths.
And is that sort of the standard? I'm just, again, I'm curious. I mean, it's, I like it because, you know, there's a lot of people that utilize our trails. If they're on a bicycle, they're not, you know,
I think it comes down to utilization and the purpose for that.
And I can provide some insight into that as well. With some of our funding we got with our trail systems, we got some DOT funding. And if we're classifying them as a multi-use trail where they're going to be multi-purpose for bikes and pedestrians, they have requirements to be a certain width. It's going to be one-way or two-way. So they have certain standards that we need to comply with. And so we basically adopted the 8-foot as our minimum with our paths, so it would accommodate a bicyclist and a pedestrian at the same time. So if technically, if it's feasible, that's what we target at a minimum.
You do occasionally get those tricycle type of situations, and those are wide. Got to be able to fit both of them.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
And if you look on the right side of the screen, the bump outs are something that we're continuing to make sure we go in and re-landscape whenever necessary. So we did a lot of refurbishment on those this year during the slow growth season, as well as replacing any of the receptacles that may get damaged throughout the year. And then all the way to the right is our line of sight. That's called a boom axe. So we have a constant rotation through the neighborhoods and the trail systems to keep the vegetation cut back for safety around intersections as well as, you know, growth along the trails. But, and then I'd be remiss if I didn't, you know, thank the parks maintenance staff for all of their work. So it really is a team effort with us, you know, installing, repairing paths. They do a lot of the upkeep every day within the parks department.
This is good because that 76% image in this city on a survey stuck. We got to change that. And this is part of it.
And since I'm bragging, a shameless plug, the 89% of overall appearance. So we have some great professionals on the landscape teams and, you know, public works department. Everybody in the city just takes a lot of pride in what they do.
Please make sure you send our regards to your entire public works team.
Absolutely.
We do appreciate it. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Just to dovetail into our resources and our programs and the amenities that we have, with a focus on increasing our service to recreational programs, that was a place where we did increase 7%. Recreational centers, one of our showcase improvements, plus 19, huge increase. And public places, 71%. And when, you know, the citizens are completing this or thinking about our amenities or thinking about the beautiful places that they go, and to the reference to the mayor's challenge of incorporating a lot of those elements so people can really experience where they may not even hear about Linear Park or Waterfront Park, and really getting them out there in a different way.
Yeah, that does go back, you know, again, to the communications aspect of it. When we started the Mayor's 9090 Challenge, I had gone online to try to figure out the current programs that were offered, just so I can try to incorporate some of those when we're planning, and it was unbelievable. And I had stated to Lauren, we need to be able to get this out to more and more of our residents, a calendar, not just the calendar of events, but truly all of. I mean, Lauren, how many programs did you tell me, the community center itself?
We had about 1,100 activities just last fiscal year at community center alone.
And that's unbelievable. Yeah. And I didn't know that. I mean, I didn't know that. So that's why I'm saying it's important for our residents to know that we do have a variety of offerings for all ages, you know, all lifestyles.
That was my question. That was going to be my question. Those 65% recreation programs, what is your feeling that those are the ones aimed at the youth or the elderly? Which one do you think that we lack on for this recreation program?
It's honestly hard to tell. We have increased our programming against all demographics, so not only the youth, but also the adult senior, and we're getting more into the adult athletics with offering yoga classes and more fitness opportunities. So we've increased our demand overall in all areas.
1,100, it's a number that's impressive. I don't 65% one. Well, maybe we have to have 2,000.
We're at almost max capacity at the community center right now. So it is tough getting in there on a daily basis.
But it's important to know.
Good job.
The increase is pretty impressive. So
now we're going to move into a little bit about our infrastructure and then to the point of public information and getting the information out to your citizens. Storm drainage, 55%. You can see another big elbow there, 20 additional percent increase. Sewer services, 8%, and public information increasing. Some of the speculation here is we did have two named storms that came in. Huge influence of council recognizing and contributing resources to where we need it, where we're hearing from our citizens. And Carl's actually here to talk a little bit more about that.
We have had a big emphasis on our stormwater system. You know, we've been working on enhancing that program, doing more projects. You know, our aging infrastructure this year are some older pipes that we went in and spin cast and lined those pipes to add to the life of those without having to replace them. So you can see we have some very big pipes. You can walk right through them. So a big improvement dealing with infrastructure, cleaning up our ditches. So we've had a lot of community outreach on educating the public on what we're doing and just system-wide number of projects we're doing, the enhancements we're having, and modeling and identifying where we need to make improvements. It's been ongoing and increasing as well.
I think this is fantastic, frankly, because, you know, again, when you're hit with back-to-back storms, obviously it has a tremendous impact on your infrastructure, but it allowed us to really put a greater emphasis on which infrastructure and prioritizing that. So to ensure that we're spending those dollars wisely in a systematic way, I'm hoping that, again, the more we can engage our residents to ensure that, you know, we have a plan, we're not being as reactive, we're being very proactive now, but this is honestly a great example. People can see that, they can understand it when a visual is put in front of them. This is something that we've invested in, and this is why. So this is fantastic.
It's funny that last week we had two compliments from residents regarding this type of...
And
usually they lack compliments. They don't get to complain. And we really had two of them the same day. Wow.
Well, I think, you know, with Tyler's reworking some of our communication to the public in a different format, this will be crucial. Because when I first got on and I was talking, you know, to Cindy when she was here and the others, I said, you know, our biggest problem, we'll sit here and we'll come up with a good idea, and it dies. It doesn't go any further. And this is where, you know, communication is everything. The citizens need to really know what's going on. Just like the picture that you just had here with Carl standing in the center tube there. Okay. There's no step ladder, so he could reach right up there. But the criticality here is people need to see that, you know. And that's your job to kind of, hey, look, this is what we're really doing. So yeah,
that's the reason why I don't like the word educate the people out there, inform the people.
Yeah,
out there.
I like that.
Information is it's what we're not about educating. We're about informing
right,
the people
right.
what we do.
That's right.
So
that's
just a,
no, you're right.
That people that I'm against that word.
And Carl's going to stay and contribute a little bit more about this area that, of course, is a huge focus of City Council. Talk about mobility. This is one of those areas overall, ease of travel, 74%. Street repair, satisfaction is at 54%. Traffic signal timing, 46%. And street lighting are actually much lower than the benchmark in that area, 34%.
And I think, honestly, that goes back to the fact that street lighting is really out of control, or out of our control when we're actually putting up poles.
Yeah.
We have funded this program, we've advanced this program, we have ensured that we prioritize this program, and it's up to FPNL. But when you're dealing with the private sector and they have other priorities, it's not only important that, again, we go back and communicate with our residents that, you know, we've made this investment, we have written a check, we are beholden to an electric company that is responsible for the infrastructure itself. So that 34% is a little disappointing to see, because this council absolutely committed to this program, reignited this program when it sat dormant, when the economy went the other way, and I'm hoping that we can really help inform our residents this year that we are doing everything possible. We have met with FPNL. We have communicated our frustration with the fact that, you know, we're waiting on these lights to be installed on Beltaire, and so that's going to be a piece that we put in to this conversation.
And now that we got that program rolling, we are starting to stay ahead with the designs to get that information as soon as possible to FPL, so we can continue that momentum going with the installations. You know, street repair, we are going to have some major roadways, you know, out to be started here. We had a pre-construction meeting. Our signal optimization with our traffic lighting, our traffic engineer that came on board is, I'd say, I call him an expert in traffic signals. He has been looking at all of our signals and having them tied in, where we brought them into our fiber and added the cameras, where we can remotely modify the timing, respond to complaints, analyze whether adjustments should be made, and make those minor adjustments. Sometimes it's just a few seconds in either direction with left turns or right turns. So he continues to finesse those timings and dealing with change in traffic patterns. You know, we don't have consistent traffic patterns in this city. So it's a lot of variations in terms of having a different times of day, having different timings. So it's an ongoing cycle to continue to fine-tune and make it better. But having that tied into our fiber and adding those cameras and continue to implement that signal optimization program is important to make that function as best as it can.
So I know we were on a phased approach before our traffic engineer came on board. I think it was halted for a period of time. So you're saying that was one of the projects he picked up? And
right. We were in the final phase of tying in. Almost all our signals now are connected. I think there's a few minor fiber connections to do on 100. As soon as those are connected, the majority of our signals are tied into our fiber system with cameras. So there may be additional steps to do that will be in addition to that, which would, you know, there's Bluetooth technology, there's different tracking things on trying to look at the overall traffic pattern and forecast where we can make the sequencing of those signals work even better. So he continues to look at that and cutting edge technology and whatnot as to what we should implement here and what makes sense for spacing our signals, our traffic flow, our roadways, because not everything is, you know, ideal for every location. So that's something he's really dived into.
You know what? I was going to talk at the end about this, and this is the proper time. Last week, someone came to me with a problem. I'm not going to go into what the problem is. And I read it by Carl, and by Michael. A day and a half later, that problem was, if not solved, very close to being solved, and they already informed me. And I didn't tell them what to do. I just asked them what was the situation, and they were right there. So kudos for you and the traffic engineer. So, because they really did a good job. So that, those are the type of things that people need to know out there. They're doing their job, and fast. So thank you, and thank you, Mike.
So with customer service, of course, our citizens being at the focus, judging their satisfaction, services provided by Palm Coast, 75%. Value of services for taxes paid, 56%. And you can see that those are actually climbers. So we're seeing an increase in these areas, treating all residents fairly, and customer service, 78%. So that was a +9 climb in customer service. And we definitely reflect on that of the services we're doing in the field and through the Palm Coast Connect app. Cynthia's here. She's going to jump in just a second. And acting in the best interest. So we're seeing dramatic climbs in those areas. I'll turn it over to Cynthia.
Good morning. So obviously those climbs, I think, had a lot to do with Palm Coast Connect going live in June. We really, really, as an organization, have geared into making sure we're getting that response time out there. We're getting the residents to realize that they can trust us, that, you know, we are getting the job done. You might not be able to see it closely in that chart, but it does show that we're under a day in response times. And as you can see, we've been working on that since June. It's gone up and down. And now that we're getting the different departments involved, and, you know, we're averaging probably about 2,000 cases a month. That's between them going on the website, them going on the app, or walking in the door, or taking a phone call. Everything's going in there, and as you can see, we're doing surveys as well. So we're trying to keep up with the surveys after they complete it to make sure that we're getting those response times up there and that they feel comfortable with what they're getting. If they had a question or concern or a topic they wanted to get more information on, that we're responsive. And I think
so, Cynthia, let me ask a question. This is interesting to me. You know, I love data. I love analytics. It's something that drives me in a lot of my decisions. So when we started this process, and I know you've been working at the city for 16 years, so you can certainly speak to, you know, the call volume and how that's increased as we've grown as a population. Do you think, I mean, this is just probably more speculation, but the call volume that was coming in at an average rate of about 10,400 calls a month, the 2,000 cases that are being logged on average, do you think the 10,400 were perhaps residents that were calling several times when their cases, it wasn't called cases before, or whatever they were called before, were not being resolved fast enough, were not being heard? Did they not feel a sense of response, you know, for no other reason, but it was manually being put out, so there wasn't necessarily out of specific tracking accountability attached to it. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you're right. 16 years, I've seen it kind of grow. And one of the things is that we've even seen some of our call volume go down a little bit because of this. You know, we're seeing the more you're getting that ability, like the first thing that they're asking when you take a phone call is, you know, would you like notification when the job's done? We never had that. You know, so we're able to get their email, and they're getting notification of every step of the way, whether it's a pothole, whether it's sewer backing up, or any of that. They're seeing it. They're seeing results, and I think that's helping drive that not calling back each time. If they're calling back, they're finding another issue out there that we need to address. They're not calling back and having that same issue saying, why wasn't it addressed? So we're having a lot more of a follow-through and proof of it. Before, you would do a work order, and you would hope that it was done. You know, there was no follow-up. There was no way of our system being able to do that. And now that we have that, it's like taking us to the next level, which is great. And residents are loving it. You know, they don't even know we have it until we start telling them, and then we're pushing it out there, and, you know, we're getting people signing up every day.
And I think that's important to denote, again, because it's not, we're not just talking about an app.
No.
we're literally talking about every case that comes in every different venue, whether you're calling City Hall, whether you're emailing City Hall, whether you're walking into City Hall, whether you are logging in to Palm Coast Connect, whether it be on our website, whether you download the app. So we are really capturing every type of engagement that comes through our doors. So, that I think is an important distinction to make, that this isn't just the app. This is coming in every single solitary time. So the knowledge-based articles, for instance, are really equally as important, because if we do have a new resident that comes in and they're asking, when is trash pickup in their neighborhood, they would normally, historically, would have called City Hall. But to have it right there on our website or on the Palm Coast Connect page or on the app itself of knowledge-based articles, now it is right there at their fingertips, where they don't even have to make the phone call now. They're like, okay, we're over in the, Seminole Woods, and we now know that trash pickup are these days. So it's the frequently asked questions that I think have helped as well.
Yeah, and I was able to, even in the articles, they rate them. So I get to see who's commonly using some of these articles and whether they're helpful or not helpful. And we laugh in our department because we go off the wall question, we put it in knowledge articles, so that if it's going to happen again, somebody can ask that question. I think we had a hog one a few months back.
And I think this app is not just about, people out there think it's about micromanagement. It has nothing to do with micromanagement. My opinion has to do with accountability.
Yep.
And that's what it does to the people out there. Holds us on our tippy toes, accountable to the people out there. People out there are Palm Coast.
It's accountability for the city as well. One of the things that I'm noticing as we go into different departments is, Public Works was a prime example. They come in at the end of the day, they might have got calls or saw things out in the field. They weren't tracking them. They fix it and be done with it. Now we have them tracking it in Palm Coast Connect so they can prep for every little thing they've done to look at resources for the future. And that's something that, we're analyzing. And we're trying to get that in that tool.
Yeah,
so it's working.
It's a tool. We're using it too.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Thank you.
Okay, now we're going to move into citizen safety. Fire services, 95%. 84% fire prevention efforts. Emergency preparedness, 81%. So that's higher than the benchmark. Crime prevention efforts, 79%. Feel safe in their neighborhoods, 95%. And 91% safe in downtown and commercial areas. And Jerry is here to talk a little bit about what the fire department is doing.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. Emergency response is somewhat like a three-legged stool. If you don't have a good emergency response or fire protection or community outreach or public education, one of those legs taken away, you're going to have a faulty product. I'm very happy to say that our organization is doing very well on all three of those aspects and expanding out furthermore into the emergency management reach. You talk about data, and data is so cool. There's two maps up on the screen. One is on the left of where the calls are, how many calls we're getting per year. And you can kind of see north of 100, everything is pretty much equally dispersed. There are a couple of red dots, a couple of black dots. Those are our hot spots where we identify where the call volumes are the highest. Could be an ALF, could be a location that is a constant reoccurring area of automobile accidents or known places that we've been visiting a lot. The map that's just to the right of that, that's our hotspots. We know that if it's green, light green, yellow, and some orange, it's really good. We also know that if it's in the red, we have some challenges, and that's what we're looking at the data today to find out where our gaps in services are. The city's goal of 7 minutes or less 85% of the time is what we've been gauging our response on. And we've been developing our own internal plans for the next 10 years to figure out what's the next place that we have to go to, what resources are we going to need, and actually, instead of building the big fire station to fix some of this stuff, what we can do in a very smaller scale to bring those numbers down to a more manageable level. One of the other legs that we're working on besides the data is figuring it out how many calls it takes to generate response. For example, we know that we're generating about 12% of our utilization within the community, which means for every 1,000 people, we have 120 calls. So if you keep that in mind,
And we know that there's a development going in, and we've been working with community development, Jose and Ray and Jason. If we know we've got 10,000 people coming in, we're going to experience a call increase of about 1,000 calls per year citywide. Those are just some numbers that we're able to take that data and plug them into developments and where we're going to be growing to, so that we can properly plan out where we need to put the next fire stations.
And that also goes to those ongoing costs. Again, it's one thing to have the capital infrastructure with the impact fees that are investing in increased capacity. It's entirely a different thing to run a fire department ongoing.
3 years ago, we didn't know what we didn't know. Now we know a whole lot more, and we're able to plan a little bit more accordingly. So with the expanding response times that we're starting to see, where we need to start plugging those gaps and making fixes, we'll be able to put together our plan and start planning for those impacts and working in the future. Our home safety program, in the picture on the upper right, is paramount. 50% of anybody who experiences a fall and a fractured hip over the age of 75 is probably going to have a catastrophic outcome. That's half of everybody who falls is not going to make it home or going to be wheelchair bound. And what our program is, since we've got such an increase in age in our community, 35% of our population is over the age of 65. We're trying to get out there to do the lifting and the ladders to check the smoke detectors so that folks don't go up and down anymore to break it up. We were out with the youth of our community. 7,000 students are contacted every year in October for fire prevention. We're also meeting with them in the spring for a touch a truck. We also have the Hall of Terror that we're out meeting with the students, because the philosophy within the department is basically this: if you're in sixth grade today, there's a likelihood that someone who's in that class is going to be a firefighter within 8 years in our community. Those are the people that we're trying to get into our department. They live local. It's part of the be local, buy local. You raise them local. You put them into the fire department. They're going to stay here. They're going to buy a house. They're going to raise a family. And they're going to recycle over and over again. And our emergency management program this year has expanded out quite a lot. Brad Clark, who's our deputy chief, has got a lot of experience in the state level. So he was up at Michael. He was integral in Irma and Matthew in the state level. He does a lot of work with his network throughout the state, but we've also added our own internal emergency manager who works directly with the county EM. It's working out great, and that person is now working with all the city departments to make sure that everybody is bringing up their emergency management plan and their information, that they can get their information out. You're only as good as the communication that you're getting in and out of your organization, and we're very pleased with where we're going with our staff today. A lot of it is the way we manage and the way the department runs. It's a bottom-up organization. A lot of these things that you're seeing or have seen in the last 2 years came from the newest member of the department who had idea we ran with it. So when you start looking at where is this information, it's getting the people on the bottom to come up with some great ideas and staying out of their way and letting them get it done. It's just been a wonderful program. So
I have a question about the coronavirus that's happening obviously all over the world, and information is getting out there. I spent some time in the ER yesterday and last night, and the emergency room was it was standing room only, frankly, hour after hour after hour. A lot of ambulances were coming in and out. How do you manage, I guess, in those moments in our community when you do see an increased volume of calls? I'm assuming some of it has to do with precautions that residents are taking very seriously. If they do have some symptoms, they're looking at. How do you manage that the cost associated with that and the resources?
You can never fully expect to pay for the cost of something like this in this scale. What we are doing is working with our partners in the county to limit our exposure. So instead of having five people show up to go to a person that's got the flu, we're only going there to assist if they need us to stay outside and limit the amount of people that go into the location. We're encouraging people, if they feel sick, they feel like they've got the flu, call your doctor. They can call stuff in. call it to the hospital, call it to the pharmacy, get whatever it is to the house. If you feel that you're showing the signs and symptoms of a coronavirus type of a thing, which is very upper respiratory, they need to make contact with the doctor and deal with them directly, as opposed to taking what they might feel is a virus and taking it to a doctor's office where there's a whole lot more people. So people have to limit their exposure getting out if they feel that they've got it. We've got the Board of Health is getting involved with going to homes and seeing what they've got. The reality is there's a lot of people that may have this virus that are walking around unaffected that are asymptomatic. They might have it, and their body's dealing with it. It's the seniors that are having the most challenge with this. So if we're encouraging people, just don't go to the hospital because you think you've got the flu, call your doctor. Call them on the phone. Stay home. Stay in your one location, and it's more manageable that way.
That's great to hear. Actually, that's a smart strategy. I didn't even think about just the infecting the resources themselves.
That's what they're doing in Portugal. They tell you, don't come to the office. Go and don't come here. We'll send somebody there to check you out.
A lot of this is reminiscent of the anthrax scare back in 2001. And every time someone saw a speck of something, and if everybody just maintains some semblance of common sense, and you look at it holistically, if you're not feeling good, don't go around people. Call your doctor and get direction from your doctor on what you want to do.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.
I was telling Matt before, my son works for J.P. Morgan in Seattle, the epicenter. And as of tomorrow, they will be working at home. And they split his office into two teams. Nobody is to go into the building. So it's going to be interesting how that plan works. But big business is starting to see the effect.
We as a city can have to start.
And we should be
this thing gets really out of hand. We have to look at things.
Right. Put some more of an essence on the ability to telecommute more than now than ever.
Not everybody could work from home.
Especially if they don't have good internet.
If you're that good, you could lay a brick from home. Not everybody could work from home.
Okay, we're going to move into one of our last categories here. We term it business friendly. This is a reflection on the economics and the satisfaction out there. Cost of living, 51%. That increased by 11%. Economic development increased 43%. And business and services overall built environment, a lot to do with a lot of the new businesses coming to town and shopping opportunities. And our Chief Development Officer, Jason, is here to talk a little bit about these slides. You're going to hear a comprehensive presentation, I believe, after this presentation. That'll really go deeper into the detail.
But you know, let me state this, because I do think, again, this goes back to communication to our residents. I was speaking to a neighborhood watch group one day, and the resident had asked a question about why we don't build a Bed Bath & Beyond in Palm Coast. And I thought, you know, the city doesn't build buildings. You know, we don't build or construct commercial retail. But commercial retail and shopping is really driven on the market, frankly. You know, we're sandwiched between St. John's County and Volusia County, both with triple the population we have in our community. So if you look at who is shopping in the stores, if you're going to drive 20 minutes south to go to outlets, Tabor Outlets, you know, does a whole market study, and they want to know that their businesses are going to be supported by the community. They want to know it's going to be a successful investment, and so a lot of data goes into that. And I will say that I do think it's important that shopping patterns have changed. Amazon didn't exist to the scale and magnitude that it exists today, to where that has changed commercial retail. So when we put out the survey questions, it's really important when we're informing our residents that these are some of the strategies we're working on. The emphasis on, you know, that process driven, right, to make it easier, that's one thing. To be business friendly and say, we're gonna make it a more enjoyable experience to come in and invest in our community. However, the market does drive a lot of these decisions. So residential rooftops always drives
you know, that type of market as well. But going back to what you just pointed to about shopping opportunities, economic development, that's where I think it's really going to be a smart strategy for us this year to try to get the information out to residents on, you know, why things are coming and why things are not coming, and why things may not ever come. Costco won't go to a region unless it has a million people that will literally support a Costco. I can guarantee that Palm Coast will never have a million people. So we have to be realistic in what our expectations can be, and what we can be as a community. However, that also goes to that quality of life that our residents love so much, and it doesn't take away from that quality of life. So all of this, I think, works together for that better experience. But I think it's equally as important to denote to our residents, if you're looking for a certain shop, we are encouraging entrepreneurship, we're encouraging startups, those sorts of things that we think are valuable to what we're trying to create for an experience. But if you're looking for the next mall to come, malls really don't exist anymore in this country because of the fact shopping behavior has changed dramatically. If you go to Volusia County and walk through Volusia County Mall, there's a reason why those shops are closing. A lot of people are shopping more online than ever before. And that's just the reality of it. But they want experiences. They want restaurants. We're seeing those sorts of experience that our residents really, it's important to them.
So if you'd like, I'd just add, good morning. The next presentation is going to talk about our addition of SCORE to our BAC and the changes that we've done with trying to help small businesses and entrepreneurs be successful in Palm Coast. So we'll touch on that later. But some of the things that we've been working on is consistency training. Make sure that you are getting a consistent review, a consistent inspection every time, which helps because we are a good sized city. We're spread out. You don't see the same inspector. We have several of them. So to make sure that you're getting the same review every time, help you really push that. I know what I'm going to get when I'm working in Palm Coast. And we've been doing a lot of outreach, stakeholder meetings, meeting with local groups to tell them, you know, what's going on, changes that are occurring in the city, and really be a little bit more proactive about, you know, what our processes, what we're trying to achieve, how we're trying to help folks grow their businesses here, and be a little bit more communication forward with that. And unless you have questions, I will see you back in a few moments.
That's good.
Thank you.
And I'm going to ask, Cynthia's working her way back up, but these are the results regarding garbage collection. Definitely a huge recovery from the past results. You can see yard waste increased by 14%, and a lot of that has to do with our efforts with the customer service and getting those complaints in and getting the satisfaction back out to our citizens. Per council direction, you did ask us as an adopted priority to look at recycling options for in the future. We're working on our next contract for waste collection, and we did ask as part of our two custom questions that we can tailor to what we want to know specifically in our community. We asked the citizens, would you support mechanical collection instead of manual? And that was 71%, 82% support recycling only targeted materials, and we had a half-half on supporting reducing the collection time to one time per week. And if you'd like to kind of chime in on our efforts.
I actually like to say that we have zero fines this month, so we're doing really good with Waste Pro. They're really stepping up. They've gotten more trucks, manpower. Communication has really stepped up in the last few months. Last year, within the last probably 6 months, you'll see that our fines have gone down a lot. Heather's done a great job as the manager down there. Our communication is right on target. We've actually even gone to the point where if we are suspect a missing street or so forth, they show video. So technology's out there showing us that, yep, we did hit that street. So we're trying to, give them that accountability a little bit more, so that we, you know, we know residents are right, but we want to also make sure they're doing it, and so we kind of get that middle ground. So it's been working really good.
And if I can mention, you know, the reason those numbers are big, I think it's important for the community to know. If you know, we, when I came on board, council was getting complaints every day, and I got complaints from all of you every day, and the mission was fix it. Our residents were telling us, meaning you, we have a problem, fix it. So because of your direction and commitment to allowing us to work a process, we have a great result. So I want to give credit where it's due and thank the council. As you've seen these positive numbers trend, it's because you guys continue to support policies, goals, and objectives that are advancing what the residents are telling you they want done. And so that's that loop and how important that is. So it's staff saying thank you for doing that, and the results are climbing and will continue to climb as we continue to act on your goals and policies.
And that is true, because you always sort of get a sense when your email volume increases substantially, and garbage collection is always something our residents will communicate with very directly and not in a...
They stop a lot.
Yes. So I have yet to receive, as of recently, a single complaint when it comes to garbage pickup. So...
And we're tracking a lot of it. I mean, we're able to see the volumes come in. So if there's a trend with our call, you know, we can see who's calling, what they're calling about with Waste Pro, whether it's a request, question, or issue. So we're fluctuating, we're evaluating those resources to see, you know, how we can fix it. So we're kind of stopping it before it gets worse. So, okay.
And this is another area that we created a tailored question as part of this survey, and we asked prior to getting the actual survey, were you aware of the campaign? And 54% were not aware of the Be Local, Buy Local. 25% was aware of the campaign and now encouraged to shop locally, and 21% aware of campaign but hasn't affected shopping habits to the conversation we just had. And this is a great opportunity to take this and actually elevate what we're doing. And Tyler, can you share a little bit about that?
These numbers are obviously disappointing, but I think it's an opportunity for us to relaunch the campaign, essentially. I don't want to unveil it too much because I know we talked about an exciting kickoff for it next month. But I will say that I'm speaking to a local group tomorrow, a future problem solvers group, and then next week on the 17th, I'm speaking to another group on Be Local, Buy Local. So we are basically going to ramp up community engagement in the next few weeks and continue that on. We're already booked for April as well, and we're booking May right now. So we're trying to do at least two to three speaking engagements per month dedicated to Be Local, Buy Local, and then work with local businesses and restaurants to cater those events and to kind of feed that cycle. And as I said, we have a really exciting campaign that we're going to kick off next month.
And I cannot think of a more important strategy than informing our residents and having a pride and ownership of, frankly, going out and spending dollars locally. It does not just support a local business, which is very significant, frankly. It keeps their doors open. But for us to collect additional sales tax dollars and not send it to another community to do more and more projects every year is so important. It helps us keep taxes low. It helps us add to the amenities, add to the quality of life. It's so important to our residents that we have to make this such a significant campaign and make it a goal that our $8.1 million that we collect every year, we should try to make a goal of saying, let's increase this number by a percentage every year, because we're now not only launching our campaign, but it's ongoing, and it's always ongoing. And we're figuring out ways to engage new residents on why it's important, or residents that have been here for so long that why it's important. And, we've talked about, our Parks and Rec and all the priorities that we have laid out. That costs money. Without those dollars coming in annually, we're going to have to either not do the projects, or we're going to have to figure out another way to pay for it. And to me, I think if a resident has a choice, not every day, you can't buy every service or good, but take pride in going to a local restaurant and then coming back and saying, I just contributed not only to a local business, I helped support that local business, I helped employ people in that local business,
But now, you know, I just gave back to the city in an effort for them to add to projects that we recognize are important. So I'm frankly not surprised by these percentages, but it, to me, it's very telling that this has been a priority for 3 years now at City Council, and I'm grateful that someone is finally taking it as serious enough to really launch a very proactive, aggressive campaign for our residents.
Look how much money you save on gas by not going away. just gas alone. And then you help us.
Yes, you help immensely. Maintain more roads. I don't like it when we're maintaining roads in Ormond Beach. I mean, you know, our money is going outside this community. And, you know, I think we can do better than that.
We will do better.
Yes.
So we'll close out the presentation with a couple more slides. As part of our annual process, we're always looking at new ways, and thank you for the comments today on how we can better engage with our citizens beyond just this survey and the homegrown survey. And these are the next steps. After this meeting, we'll start working with you and your schedules and try to get those one-on-one interviews and start talking about going forward, where do you want us to elevate, carrying your priorities to the next step, and come back to you. April 14th is our schedule for the first workshop. At the same time, we're talking about the 10-year CIP, and we're really starting to kick into the budget process. We do have a placeholder for May 12th to do another workshop if needed, and ultimately to come to the adoption of your new focus areas moving in, or to continue the evolution of where you've already started to guide us. And again, coming that full circle on your priorities and revisiting that, and even these sessions that we have with you and trying to improve the process overall.
So this is a question for you, Matt. You know, historically, our annual report would be sort of identifying the goals and strategies and, you know, how we have fared this year and addressing these goals. How are you changing the process to make it not so labor-intensive, for lack of a better word, of these teams that historically were just working on goals subset G2, 4, 6, 7, for what reason? Like, how are you now taking this, which I think, frankly, is such a valuable process of the strategic planning. It's one of the most important things this council does every single year. But how do you then, as an administrator, manage that process to not just attach resources unnecessarily?
So there's two things that we're going to that have changed and that are changing through this process that will begin to hopefully affect that. One is, we call it metrics that matter. There was a lot of dashboards, there was a lot of gas needles telling you a lot of different things. What the challenge has been to staff, what we've been working through, is identifying inputs, identifying outputs, but more importantly, identifying outcomes. Why are we doing projects? What was the direction? What was the guidance? So trying to hone in and report on metrics that matter to you as a council, that matter to a community, and find those key drivers, those key strategies that are, like we say, if we can accomplish one goal or policy, that's fantastic in and of itself. If we can accomplish a goal or policy that is translating across departments and breaking down silos and lifting up multiple departments, that's an outstanding metric. So trying to identify those and bring those to council, point those out, what we think those are. And second is, as you're all aware, this is the first time, and we don't know the full extent yet, but we're actually going to have internal data from our Palm Coast Connect Hub and from our dashboards to try to begin to understand where we're really succeeding and how that aligns with SAP priorities and what we're actually accomplishing, where resources are sufficient or where resources are, you know, in a great spot, to where we also maybe can have a conversation with you about where resource allocations, additional resources, resource shifts should occur to start bolstering or bringing up some of those areas that might need a little help in elevating those numbers. So we're kind of looking at it from those two facets moving into this year's evaluative process.
To the point of Mr. Morton's overview is we have been meeting with Cynthia and looking at the capabilities of Palm Coast Connect and actually possibly translating our measurements that we have now and looking at how they can be integrated into that dashboard. So consolidating what we're doing and homing in onto the metrics more than, you know, the language part of it.
So I like that.
Yep. So that's going to be good and transformative for us.
Yeah, it'd be nice when we get, you know, the report also, you know, to be able to go through and go, wow, this is the goal, this is the strategy, this is the outcome, let's move on to the next goal, right? Thank you. Okay. So agenda item number E3 is a presentation of SCORE and business review.
So thank you, Honorable Mayor and Council. We have Tom Hellman from SCORE. We have Jason DiLorenzo. I'm just going to preface it by reminding you about 8 or 9 months ago, I ended the relationship with the SBDC because I didn't feel like it was meeting the expectation, delivering on the promise of business friendly in an outward way that was changing towards this entrepreneurial ecosystem that we were trying to build. So a couple things happened. We engaged with Tom Hellman, who was, are you still the chapter president of SCORE?
No, I've moved on.
You moved on. But SCORE's a local asset in our community. We did some in-house work with what we call now our BRX, our Business Review Extreme. And then I think this presentation is important because it's stage one. It's going to tell you what we've done and what we've accomplished, what we're doing internally. But there's a big piece to this that we'll tie on at the end, which is we recently just hired, as some of you know, our systems architect, entrepreneurial ecosystem, director of implementation and architecture, we call it, and entrepreneurial ecosystems. And the idea being that with BRX, with SCORE, and with Engaged, we're trying to move towards a true entrepreneurial ecosystem. One of the foundational barriers to economic development is removing process barriers. And so what we're focused on is using our technology, using our physical assets, to remove all these barriers, these stumbling blocks, to create a more efficient, effective, and responsive business process in the city. So we're using the traditional processes. Now we're going to use our existing technology and leveraging new technology with Cynthia, with this business team. We're calling it the Innovation Triangle. We have some employees identified that are going to help us now take barriers down and continue to grow our ecosystem and become more business friendly.
Okay, sorry about that. We have to find it because.
Well, it's a good thing I just went on.
Yes, thank goodness.
Giving you cover.
Thank you for that. Because this presentation got bumped from the previous workshop. So we're going to go track it down. So, Tom, please.
Thank you. First of all, I want to say on a personal note, I was very excited with the opportunity to come here and share with you some information about SCORE. But after hearing the presentation that just occurred, I'm even more excited. Because what I see is not only an effort to really do the sort of mundane basics well, but also a forward-thinking effort. And that's something that SCORE wants to be part of. And also, just on a personal note, when we moved here, my wife and I had a choice of living anywhere in the United States. Anywhere in Florida? We chose Palm Coast for the same reasons that you do. And we stay here for the same reasons that you do. We think it's a great place to live. And we want to do our part as part of SCORE and as a citizen to sort of help promote that as we go forward. That said, what I'd like to do in the next few minutes is really cover three areas, provide you information with regard to SCORE. One would be an overview of SCORE itself. I know many of you may have varying knowledge associated with SCORE. And I'll talk about the national organization briefly and our local chapter. Secondly, talk about where we are with regard to our long-term and growing partnership with the city of Palm Coast. And finally, what I call my improvements and opportunities slide. As we look toward the future, what is it that we need to improve and where is that opportunity space that we want to capitalize on as we go forward? What's the familiarity with SCORE? How many people have heard of SCORE and know it quite well, besides the mayor? We've had a long-term relationship with the mayor in different roles during our career. Okay, well, let me give you some of the basics. SCORE was created by the SBA in 1964 as a volunteer-based service partner. By volunteer-based, what that means, as you might imagine, is we don't get paid for what we do. Our payoff is the success of our clients. And our clients tend to be small business entrepreneurs and the like. We're a national organization with over 10,000 volunteers like myself and our colleagues in the chapter, and about 300 chapters, 22 of which are located in Florida. Our mission is, and I say this in kind of an easygoing way, is to help entrepreneurs and small businesses realize their dreams. And we do this by providing free and confidential mentoring. We don't charge for our services, whether it's mentoring, whether it's a workshop that we put on, or whether it's the educational materials that are provided on both our chapter's website or our national website, which are pretty profound. And what's interesting is that when SCORE started, it was called the Service Corps of Retired Executives, which of course is very interesting when you think about it. In 1964, our chapter started in 1965, by the way. But in 1964, what did a retired executive look like? Looked like me. Age-wise, gender-wise, ethnicity-wise. In today's world, that's not as good as it needs to be. And one of the things that SCORE has done nationally has begun to embrace the notion of diversity in all those three areas. So one example is, I was actually the district director, which meant that seven chapters of SCORE across Florida reported to me. Our chapter president, that I was before that, became ill, so I came back on an acting basis until we could find someone to do the job. The person who did the job is half my age. And he's got a job as well. This is great. He can relate in a way that, you know, I could a few years back, perhaps more effectively. But I think we're very blessed to have that kind of diversity. We have more women. We have about 33% of our chapter is women, younger. And it's just terrific the way it's moving. And it gives us a better opportunity to serve our clients more effectively. Our local chapter serves both Volusia and Flagler County. We have over 40 volunteers. And one of the critical elements of being a volunteer in SCORE, we go through a vetting process, is that you have experience that you can bring to bear to support our clients. Most people that apply pretty much have that. And they'll vary from people like myself, who was a corporate executive at GE, Bristol-Myers Squibb, companies like that, to people who actually have owned companies, smaller companies, people who work for public and private types of organizations, some nonprofits. So we have a vast variety of people in terms of professional development and expertise. We have some lawyers. We have accountants. We have a person like myself who's actually a technical kind of person. And so we can provide guidance in a number of different ways. One way being general guidance. And most of the people that come in to see us, general guidance usually is very helpful. We also have subject matter experts in the areas I mentioned, accounting, marketing, and the like, where we need specialized help. The chapter actually has been a pretty high-performing chapter. Over the last 5 years, we've been a platinum chapter, which really is a national designation based on data, performance data, things like how many mentoring sessions you had, how many people came to your workshops, etc., as well as operating efficiency. Operating efficiency would be things like clients not yet counseled. So if you have, you want to have a client that is identified and counseled, hopefully a counseling date set up within 48 hours. And so we're pretty good at doing that kind of stuff. And that's what operating efficiency has to do with, as well as quality of performance. Last year, which would be last fiscal year, the chapter held some 120 face-to-face mentoring sessions and about 215 cyber mentoring sessions in Flagler County. Our statistics generally handle Flagler County as opposed to specifically Palm Coast, although I'll tell you there are some Palm Coast specific statistics that we do have. The point being that cyber, and just so you understand what cyber is, it's where we have use of email, telephone, perhaps Skype type of connections with our clients, is really growing over time. That represented 60% growth year over year. The face-to-face were 20% growth over year. The point I'm trying to make is we had pretty darn good performance in Flagler County, most of which the clients resided either in Palm Coast or have a business in Palm Coast. So, quite frankly, Palm Coast drives Flagler County in terms of performance. what we do. I mentioned earlier that we've had a long-term partnership with Palm Coast, and it goes back, Madam Mayor, for many years, much before my time even. But I'll tell you one thing that I found very interesting about this partnership. It's performance-based. Now, you may say, well, so what? The so what is, as district director, as I said, I had responsibility for chapters from Jacksonville to Citrus County. No other chapter had a relationship with the city where it was a performance-based type of grant. Normally the grants were, okay, here's $5,000 or $3,000, do with it as you will. Palm Coast was different, and when we designed our relationship, we said, you know what, we want to demonstrate value. And the city, of course, said, we want to receive value for what we give you. We don't want to just give a donation. And so what we decided is that we would establish a value per hour of counseling, give an hour of mentoring and prep time. So we would get credit as SCORE mentors for that time, and that would be given a certain value in terms of price. Now, there's a cap. That would be the grant, basically, the cap. We always exceeded it, by the way, in terms of what we could have gotten. Just to let you know, that dollar amount on an hour was $30 an hour. Now, think about that. Just to give you an example, when I retired, I became a consultant. My fee for nonprofits was $150 an hour. For profitable organizations, it was more. That was 10 years ago. So the value proposition here, if you want to monetize it, is pretty darn good. That's what we want. We want you to feel like, you know what, we really get value for what you give us and what you provide for us. What's happened is October of last year took a whole new dimension. As Matt pointed out, we had conversations, and the idea was, would SCORE be willing to come in? We'll provide an office at the BAC. You can provide mentoring out of that office. We thought that was a splendid idea, by the way, because historically we didn't have the ability to have an office, to have a location, and to be associated with a program like the BAC, which we saw was forward-thinking and gave us the opportunity to attract more clients to our organization. So it was amazing how welcoming the organization was between Matt, Jason, Donald, and the people in BAC. Just embraced us and really helped us get started, putting simple things like helping us get a computer in the office so we could operate out of that office, about giving us, I don't have my tag on, but giving us a tag that allows us to come in at off hours to our office in case we have clients that can't come during the normal working hours because they have jobs or because they have businesses that they're running. So that's basically when we started, and I just want to say we did feel very welcoming on that, and we're appreciative of that, Jason and Matt, for that. Just to give you a sense, now we're right in the beginning stages of this. We just started in October, but the first quarter results showed an increase of mentoring sessions of 17%, and that was 10% face-to-face and about 20% cyber, which is what we see happening. Cyber is growing, and face-to-face still is important, but what we'll do is we'll typically have the first face-to-face in our City Hall office. Then, if it's more comfortable, we will have it in another location. If a person has a business, we'll be in their business location. So not all our counseling will take place in City Hall, but the availability of an office is very important to us. And so what we've seen is a terrific start for a program that we see going forward, and we're very pleased with what we see so far. Speaking of going forward, this is what I call my improvement and opportunity slide. One of the areas that we really need to work on both at the SCORE side, hopefully once we get our act the way it needs to be, we can embrace it with the city, is how we get appointments. Historically, the appointments could be set with the BAC when people came in to pay their business taxes at City Hall. However, during time, what's happening is that that tax is being paid online more so than it is in person. So one question is how do we become more effective in getting our services, the clients aware of our potential services. And so what's happening at score as a national organization right now is we are making a transition to a new customer relations management program. Big deal. As anybody who deals with these things knows, it's huge. In fact, our chapter is what you call an early adopter, and we're planning on going live in the next couple of weeks with regard to this. This will impact how we do our appointments, how we deal with all these things. And we wanted to get that squared away before we really entered in some thought with the city is about how we could be more effective in working together. It didn't make any sense to try to connect the legacy system. It was horrible, and we're very happy to move away from it. So one of our improvements as we look toward the future is to really embrace a more effective appointment setting system. Seems like a mundane thing, but increasingly important to how we get our clients and connect with our clients. Now, the exciting stuff, I think, is working on developing some innovative and really relevant workshops for our clients. We listen to what's going on here and listen to Jason here in a few minutes. There's just so much that's being put together by the city to support small businesses. And we hope to be part of that front end of that. When the small business isn't quite a small business yet, but an entrepreneur, we hope to help that entrepreneur bridge to becoming a small business and handing it off to Jason and his team. And so we just want to make sure, as was discussed earlier, sometimes our clients don't know what they don't know. Sometimes the citizens don't know what they don't know. And just listening to what we discussed this morning at this meeting, it's incredible stuff. I mean, yeah, we can sort of look at certain areas and say, yeah, we need improvement here. But one thing that struck me, did you notice all the curves? How many curves went that away and how many curves went that away? Mm-hmm. I mean, that in itself is the telling story with regard to what we're doing directionally in this city today. And that's a story that we really need to be sure people understand. And we hope to contribute to that story in that economic development space. So we hope to be able to feature some of what the city's doing in a workshop program, provide some leading-edge workshops on business fundamentals, and maybe market the workshops a little better by combining our marketing resources, both the city and SCORE, together. I'm optimistic that once we get our sort of act together, this will be an area that will provide value to our entrepreneurial community. I'll leave you with a couple final thoughts. You say, well, why is it that you do something like this? Why don't you go play golf or tennis or pickleball or something like that? The reason why, and I'm sure this is part of all 10,000 of us who do this on a voluntary basis, is our success is the success of our client. I feel good when I look at that client and know they got something. Realize that when a client comes to see us, we're not consultants. We don't tell them how to do it. We put them through a process of self-discovery so they learn how to do it. They don't have to call us the next time. They can, and we'll help them. But we want to develop the person as well as the development of the business opportunity. And so one of the quotes here about the measure of success is, are you able to manifest your talent through others? And that's what we try to do. To the extent that we have talent, a repository of some knowledge, some of it dated, I confess, but some of the basics are still there, and they're valuable to these people. And finally, Daryl Royal, of course, shows my age, former Texas football coach, said, potential just means you ain't done it yet. And our point is, we want to make sure these people do it. Now, that said, there's an old Zen saying, blow and you can start a fire, blow you can put out a fire. And so we have to be balanced in how we deal with our clients. In some cases, putting out the fire is the right thing to do. They're doomed to fail. And we go through a process of self-discovery. In some cases, we love the case where we can help them grow, develop, and become successful. So I just want to thank the council and the mayor and Jason, Matt, your support in this endeavor, and I hope that when we come back the next time, we'll be able to give you some results that both of us feel pretty good about.
One of the things that's interesting, I initially really felt when I learned about the BAC and everything it offered as far as free to the business community, and yet so few businesses knew it existed in this community. That was a challenge first and foremost, especially the small startup businesses, the entrepreneurs that were struggling just to figure out, you know, what they needed for their business to grow. So taking away that duplication and partnering with SCORE, a valued resource that was underutilized, I think, in our community, really does add that value to that entrepreneur ecosystem. But I think also what it does, hopefully, it helps take that silo down. So when someone is coming in for a business license, or we have that information available to them now. Now we're able to inform the business owner that this is a service we have available to you as a city. We want to help you become successful. And we have, the best in the market of advisors that will help you not only start up, grow with an idea, a concept, the dreamers, we call the entrepreneurs, these are the risk takers, the dreamers. It's helping them stabilize a little bit more, year one, year two, year three, as they invest in our community. So I'm excited about this partnership because, again, it takes down that unbelievable silo that we had sitting in our city hall that wasn't a bad service. It just no one really was aware of it. And so getting out in the community, I think, is such an integral part of this, getting in front of as many residents as possible, speaking to our business community as much as possible is really going to be, I think, the success of this partnership. So I look forward to the workshops and anything we can do to support that. Please let us know.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. All right, so I'm going to move on to BRX, Business Review Extreme, and I know you've heard about it quite a few times, but we're going to give you a good overview of what we've tried to achieve. And Mayor, I know you've heard the stories. I'm sure you've all heard the stories. Moonrise and others who really struggled to get open in a timely fashion in our community. So we put together a team and we tried to analyze what issues were occurring, understand the workflow that was happening, create some new tools to help our staff and entrepreneurs and small businesses be successful, and then we created the BRX itself. So we had
Jason, I just want to say, that's interesting. When you first said BRX,
yeah,
it reminded me of my first TRX class that was very painful.
Yes.
So I hope I know.
Well, we on the planning side of our business, we have the TRX,
yes,
Technical Review Extreme. And that this is modeled off of that program. That is we have a set time every Wednesday where developers can just call and come in and have a discussion about what they're considering doing or thinking about doing, or maybe they're a little bit further down the line and they need a group of staff in the room to kind of review where they are in the process. And that's what we're doing with BRX, where when we have an issue, we come on, we have time, we put you in a room and we'll try to figure out what you're trying to do, and we'll get to all that. So we put together a team from multiple divisions and departments. We had Patrick and Barbie helping us from the building division, Tracy and Jackie from zoning, Jay and Sandy from finance, and Randy Holmes from the fire department as well. That all worked on this, and it was months of work, several meetings to get to where we are today. And I want to thank that group for all the work they put in. So some issues. Okay, permits, communication, big issues that we were having. So on the permit side, we have a section in our code of ordinances that says no business tax receipt shall be issued for any business until the location thereof has been approved by the Development Service Director of the city and a certificate of occupancy issued, and there are no exemptions. So a couple things with this. One, it's inconsistent with Florida Building Code, and we're going to bring you back an ordinance change in the future to do a little bit of cleanup on that. But I want to talk about what a certificate of occupancy is. It's issued when you build a new building, or when you have a change of occupancy use category. Now that is not a tenant, and this is how we were applying it because of our code, is that you had a change in tenant, we were trying to issue a new certificate of occupancy. And that was causing us a lot of problems. So
let me ask you then, going back to the case study of Mice Brewery, I think it's a great example of, frankly, what we should never do again. So was this applied because it was a change in occupancy where they were trying to apply the same standards when it was a brand new business that microbreweries were new to the city? You can have a lot of examples of the weight of the tanks, and it kept sort of getting kicked back, and the company itself, the business itself, had to spend a lot of money on engineers to figure out, to comply with a lot of the standards. And so use that as a case study to help me, you know, really drive this home, because I do think that's a good example of how one size doesn't fit all. And we should be looking at also the value of the company that's coming in, and also making sure we're working with them as a partner, not necessarily as, okay, you're just another number that's coming in.
Okay. All right, so the previous use at Moonrise was a restaurant. And then the building and planning, building and zoning, tried to apply this ordinance to the new business coming in, right, the brewery, and they said, okay, you need a certificate of occupancy based on this ordinance, and then that led them down a path that made a lot of additional requirements that you wouldn't expect from going to a restaurant, essentially a restaurant to another restaurant type of business that has a slightly different business model. And because they tried to apply all that, they then needed to show compliance with the new codes that had been introduced and everything else in between when that original business started and when the new business came in.
So and that took a year.
It took a long time.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And I don't intimately know the knowledge of exactly what happened with all that. I know it was part of the type of building construction and everything that was leading them down this path to have a lot of engineering work done to prove that they were not going to, you know, affect the safety of the safety of the building.
Yeah. Okay.
So we now have, and I provided you some of our new tools here, and one of the things we built was this declaration of renovations and remodeling. That's this one here. It's the black and white one. So basically, St. Johns County uses a similar form to help the building and zoning departments understand what you're trying to change, if anything, in your business. And this is a self-attest. To what you're doing. So if you're saying, well, I was an insurance office and now I'm going to be a real estate office, and the very bottom line is no alterations and I'm not making any changes, I'm just going to, they're moving their computer equipment out, we're moving our computer equipment in, no alterations, you self-assess, we sign off on it and we send you back to business tax receipt and they issue it. Even if you have a minor repair, as classified by the Florida Building Existing Code, that wouldn't affect your opening. I have some wall patching to do, paint, and so on. Not a problem. We're still going to sign off on it, and you can go back to the BAC, and they can issue the business tax receipt. Now, if you're doing anything above that, if you're doing a level one alteration, or all the way down to a change of occupancy, so that's the change of occupancy type. And our building official likes to say, if you're going from the daycare to the dynamite factory, change in occupancy, then we need to find out more information. We need to know what you're really trying to do so we can help you achieve that. So this is our first tool to understanding what the business is trying to do and weed out the ones that we can say, yep, you're good to go, go get your business tax credit and get started, or, well, that seems like you're doing a pretty big change there, let's talk about it some more.
And your team, you're saying on Wednesdays, helps facilitate this?
This happens over the counter. Okay. This part happens over the counter. Okay. So you go to the BAC, you start filling out your local business tax form, and then you come over to zoning and you sit down with the zoning technician, and they ask you a series of questions, which includes these, and then you self-attest to what you're doing or not planning to do to the interior or exterior. Because even if it's an exterior, it could be like a sign or something like that, which will need zoning review to make sure that you're fitting the plan development code for signs. So we're doing that over the counter. And I'll get to the next steps, but I'm going to kind of tell you how we got there. Okay, we realized there was a process issue, and we put it on the board, and then we put it on the board some more. And then we put it on the board some more, and we kept on working it out until we got to a much more simpler process where we are now. And we were able to say right off the bat, these things don't need a permit. If you're only changing the tenancy, you don't need a permit.
So do you think it was two things that was causing issues for us? Do you think it was process driven and sort of behavior? Starting from a place of yes and figuring out how we solve it?
Well, I think the code of ordinances was, and the heavy-handed kind of use of it, or reliance on it.
Okay.
Was part of the problem. So I suppose you could say that's coming from a point of no, because you're starting with, I need to do this every time,
mm-hmm.
Rather than I'm trying to understand what you're trying to achieve and get you there.
Okay.
So minor repairs, no alterations. Like I said, we're gonna sign off on it and send you back. And Mayor, permit, process, and communication were the three main issues
okay.
that we're trying to solve.
Okay.
And so this gets down to the process side. Now, like I said, if you're going to make a major alteration in the building, you're probably going to need a building permit. Are there times when you can get a building permit and still open? Yes, there are, because it's not going to affect the life safety process of the building. You're going to make an alteration that's going to allow you to open, but you still have a plan, and we're going to get you through that as well. We're not going to just go say, go do that, and then come back, and we'll sign off on your tax receipt. So we've simplified the process, and we've done some training to help our technicians understand this as well. And then this goes to what I was saying about, we were heavy-handed in compliance, and we didn't have a point person to actually get people through the process, and we were struggling with follow-up and not really understanding the time sensitivity that entrepreneurs generally have, because a lot of times they've already signed their lease, they're waiting to open, they need to have cash flow, and they're struggling to get through our process on their own. So what we did to solve this is we now have a project manager, we did technician training, and we formed the BRX meeting itself. Okay, so back to this declaration, right? They come across, the technician's sitting with them, and they say, well, I need a level one or maybe level two, level three, I'm not sure. And we go, okay, hold on, let me get the building official. And now the building official is quite busy, he's not always in the building. But if he is, he's gonna come to the counter and he's gonna have a conversation with the new business and try to understand what they're doing. If that can be done over a short period of time, right over the counter, we're gonna solve it right there. We're gonna say, okay, sounds like you need this, this, and this. You're gonna need this site plan, this life safety plan. Gather that stuff up together and submit for a permit, and we're gonna get you through the process, and we're gonna get you there. If they go, well, I'm not really sure, the client's like, I think I'm gonna do this, but I this might cause other issues to occur. We also created this color sheet here, the supplemental sheet, which kind of goes through all the different
building code occupancy types and tries to fit that business into one so we can understand, oh, well, if you're going from this to that, these are the type of alterations that you're going to have to make, and these are the, this is what you're going to need to apply for to get there. Now, like I said, we're trying to do this over the counter, but you know that's not always feasible. The client doesn't always have the paperwork or the understanding of what they need. And if that's the case, or if the project manager or the building official is not available at the time, then Thursday mornings we have BRX, and we'll just schedule them for the next BRX, the next one that comes up. We have them pre-scheduled on the calendar. All the technicians can just put them right into a position for whenever that next one is. Have that conversation with them about what they need to bring to that meeting so it's a successful meeting and so we can move them on to the next step, whatever that might be.
Do you have a guesstimate on the proportions that would fall into that later category where you kind of have to front run them to make sure that they provide the correct paperwork or whatever additional information they need to bring the next day because they weren't able to satisfy it when they came in prior? Is it? I don't know the split. It could be 80-20. It could be 90-10. Could be 50-50.
I don't know. Okay. But I'll work on getting the answer curious on what it is.
Because I need to see resource allocation.
So the BRX meeting itself, they're on Thursdays. We have 2 hours blocked out for them. We scheduled them in 30-minute increments. And we've had some folks go through it. Like I said, we try to help them over the counter. We don't want to have to push them off to a couple days later or a week later. We don't have to. We want to try to help them when we can. But if we need to, we'll schedule them for this time. And so several folks have this two-hour window blocked off on their calendar. They don't schedule anything else in it. If someone gets scheduled for that, then they attend. If they are not, then that's free time to go back to your regular work day.
And is SCORE in any of those conversations? If it gets to a point like they need some sort of marketing strategies, or do you have any help with that? Do you ever offer that in those conversations?
We don't, but when Tom was here, I was thinking that exact same thing, that it's, I don't know if we would need SCORE in the room, but we should definitely be providing materials and having a discussion with them about what's available in City Hall to help them, improve their business. So we'll include that.
Every business, like you're saying here, has a different need, right? And so I do think whether it be business loans, marketing strategy, a business plan itself, those are items I think would be very helpful during this process to be communicated. Again, always communicating with the user, saying these are services, this is for you, this is really important, attend this workshop.
We will incorporate that.
Okay.
Yeah. So the supplemental sheet helps us in another way. It helps us know who needs to be in the BRX meeting to help them with the process. So it helps us identify the issues. It helps us identify who needs to attend the meeting. So we have the right people in the room who can answer the appropriate questions, and we can get the client moving on to the next step. And that's really the key, is they're understanding, a clear direction, right? Giving the client a clear direction on what they're trying to achieve and how we can help them get there. So these one-on-one meetings have been very effective. We've had a few people go through them now. And Fatima was in, I would say about 2 months ago, and she's building a coffee shop right across the street from Holland Park. And she came in. She was one of our first clients that went through the BRX, and she's looking forward to having a successful business there. So
we should make sure we connect her with Tom.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's not her first business either. She has another business in town as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
and then Scott Campion, who is the owner of the Cork and Pint, is looking to expand his business into and have a restaurant as well. So he came in and met with our folks, and he's on his way to making that a reality, and we wish him success with that. And that's all I have, unless you have some questions for me.
This is great. I think when we're talking about startups and businesses coming in or expanding or growing, I think when we're talking also about the business unfriendly,
It also comes to the contractors themselves. Are you working on a strategy of those that are coming in, whether it be, I know I have a friend who is a pool builder, lives here but doesn't do a single ounce of business here because the process has been so frustrating for them. Mm-hmm. They build pools in Jacksonville, they build pools in St. Augustine. I ask him, you know, what exactly the pain points were, but I do think it'd be important maybe for us to reach out maybe through the Home Builders Association and try to identify areas that are either process-driven, behavior-driven, communications-driven, where we're also reaching out to the contractors themselves that are the, you know, plumbers and the roofers and to help, you know, continue to build that relationship and identify the pain points.
Yeah, please have them contact me. We're meeting with contractors all the time, you know, to try to understand, you know, where our processes are breaking down for them. And it's always a little bit different, you know, for each one, or, you know, where they're struggling within our structure and how we can make our structure work better for them. So please have that. And if all of you, if you have anyone, you know, that is coming to you, please have them contact me or give them, you know, let me know and I'll contact them. And we'd love to sit down and talk to them about what's going on.
How to be users of the system is really important to get a better understanding of, you know, what is their feeling. Because they're also the ones that are going out in the community talking about the relationship they have with the City of Palm Coast. And then the third aspect of this is the actual resident that's pulling a permit in City Hall. I had first mentioned when we were going through the new city manager process of hiring how another friend of mine, two executives that work in the community, were just trying to build a shed in their backyard, and it got kicked back, I think, four times before they had to make their way into City Hall. And it wasn't necessarily the comments were coming back in a way that were clearly identified for them. So it was just, no, this isn't going to work. No, this is going to work. So I don't know if that's changed or not.
It has. So we have a policy that if on plan review, if you're on your second review and you're still not able to make it through, we call. And we don't just send it back and let you try and figure it out. We'll give you a call and ask you to come in and meet, or we'll try to do it over the phone and work through what the concern is to try to move you along.
And that goes back to customer service.
Yep.
You know, every business, every resident, every, you know, client that's coming in City Hall, they are a customer. They are a customer of our City Hall. And so their experience should be, again, valuable, appreciative of their time, and measuring the outcomes of how long it took them to get through that process.
I feel that more people are getting used to or comfortable being able to come in and speak to us about stuff. We had a home builder in last week who was struggling with a particular issue, and so we talked about it, said, hey, this can help you, try it this way, can we give you, would you like training on our online system, we'd be happy to set that up for you with your permit technician, because they were hand delivering all the permits, you know, which is less common in this day and age, right? Especially since we had the technology there to accept the permits online.
And how are you launching this BRX campaign? How are you launching it to inform those that are needing to use it?
Well, it's kind of it's
strategy.
It's natural because it comes right that when you go to apply for your business tax receipt, you have to come see zoning, so it's automatic. So it's happening at our level because you have to come see us anyway. We're engaging you right away when you come to us.
I think it should be a communication strategy. I think it could be a good campaign to demonstrate the change that has occurred in City Hall, why we think it's important, why it's been important to, you know, have you analyze and whiteboard it and figure out process-driven items. I think it'd be a worthwhile exercise to communicate that to our residents. Our perception has been we are not business friendly. None of us could figure out really or pinpoint the actual moment and what needed to happen. And you know, you're certainly coming up with a solution that would be helpful to the process.
And I think we need to continue to communicate that to the residents, the business community, the users of the system as well.
Okay.
Okay.
That will work out.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Great.
Mm-hmm. Good job.
All right,
thank you. Next on our agenda item number is E4, a presentation of Flora Park Drive.
Thank you, Honorable Mayor and Council. We have Carl coming up to bring us up to date on our public outreach workshop we had, and also where we're at in the process. We've had some very successful strategies already, and we're hearing positive feedback from residents of Flora Park Drive. Share some of the citizen input we received and what the remaining next steps are and a timeline to get this completed. Should I keep talking?
This has been an ongoing project where we've been doing numerous items associated with Flora Park Drive. Since we met last and did a presentation, we held a community outreach meeting. And it was very well attended. We had over 70 plus attendees, roughly 58 households represented, came out, spoke to multitude of staff that were there. We also had sheriff's representatives there as well to discuss enforcement and other issues. Some of the things that we've done since we last met with you and gave you an update, we adopted the ordinance. We went up and put up the additional signage, identifying the alternate truck routes, the limitations of the trucks on the roadway, notifying mapping application companies of the road restriction. So all that was a lot of positive feedback. The residents, even during the meeting, mentioned that they had noticed a visual reduction in truck traffic. They weren't certain if there still was through traffic, but they did say there's definitely a reduction based on the outcome of this additional signage. And the sheriff's office is focusing on doing some enforcement as well. Some of the feedback we got from the citizens during that meeting and that we're looking to incorporate or study would be three items came up. One was the stop bar locations on either end of Flora Park Drive, basically not allowing that turning movement at the ends, sight distance. So we did look at that. We agree there is some stop bar work that could be redone, not only here, but some other locations along Palm Coast Parkway as well. So we're looking at restriping and taking care of those stop bars in that location and some others with some upcoming roadway striping work. There was a concern about there was a patch that was done on Flora Park Drive. The patch was very poor. It failed quickly. There's still some issues with the patch. So, you know, we have numerous times while we do patching. It could be utility repair or stormwater repair. It could just be bad asphalt, you know, stormwater erosion. It could be multitude of things. So just looking at what the process is for doing repairs with multiple people that do roadway repairs and trying to come up with a standard for doing an asphalt patch and whether we do a follow-up inspection and making sure that it was done properly. So it is a good way to look at our current process and see if we can improve it. Another item was at Holland Park, looking at putting up possibly a flashing light there. So we're going to look at that entrance to Holland Park, especially with the proposed improvements. It's going to be a lot more traffic coming in and out of that park. It's going to be very active. If there is development across the street with that, you know, business that was just presented to you, maybe some foot traffic. So maybe we put in a mid-block crossing, maybe a strip, and maybe a flashing light. We're going to look at all options, see if something should be done to make it safer and better for users of that roadway and the park users as well. So the remaining items that we were moving forward with were the landscape grant program. So we are in the final steps of finalizing the grant application and program requirements, and we'll be going out to bid for some, having a price list of materials basically that the property owners can utilize when they're putting together a plan, as well as having some pre-qualified contractors that can be used. And we'll open the period up in the summer, and then ideally the work will be done in the winter for the growing and watering season is going to have the most success. So that's kind of the time frame of moving forward with that. Our canal and landscaping, the next step is really to complete the design of addressing the two canal ends that are city-owned property there and looking at which option makes the most sense technically. And then we would look at the cost of those improvements and work it into our future CIP program. And then roadway restriping, we talked about when we do resurface the roadway, which is probably beyond the five-year plan right now, is currently scheduled, we would modify the striping to narrow down the lanes and help promote, you know, a reduction in speed as well.
So what's the time frame on all of these items, remaining items?
Well, the landscape grant will be this summer. Our goal is to go out with the application period so we can collect grant applications this summer. Okay. And then we would make the award coming. So the first round of improvements would be this next winter.
Okay.
And then landscaping would be this fiscal year. We have some dollars in the budget for Photo Park Drive. We would move forward with the design this year so then we could plug it into the CIP and see where it fits into the CIP. If it's going to be phased approach or, you know, which option we do. And then the striping is over 5 years out. It's not.
So we're looking at, I the landscaping to me, I think, does add, again, to the aesthetics to the roadway. It also allows for much softer drive as you're going through there. So are you looking at the entire landscaping project and then budgeting that out so we don't piecemeal this? I mean, I think it would be sort of odd if you're landscaping one aspect of it and then you're going to another part of the road and it's there.
Yeah, the landscape on the residential property would come to the city and seek.
Yeah, no, I mean the other.
Oh, the other,
yes.
One? Yeah, we would. I'm not sure if I understand the question again.
So the landscaping that we are actually introducing and have shown, I think, in past slides.
Yes.
Are we budgeting for that? Is that part of this process?
That would be part of the process. We're going to do the design and put some costs together. And
okay.
When we do the five-year plan budget, we'll see where it plugs into the five-year plan based on the dollars.
And when is that going to be done?
The design we'll do this fiscal year. Okay. The construction, we have to see, because it's the same funds that pay for street resurfacing, so we have to see where it best fits in the budget. So we'd really be looking for direction from council.
Yeah, I was going to say, we're going to do the design options this year, the next couple of months, bring those back to you, and they'll be evaluative options depending on cost and what the ultimate objective is and how it's going to align with the landscape grant program so we get some synergy across the city-owned properties and the private properties. We're working that now. Our landscape architect and design is working very hard on getting those ideas together. So we're really trying to target wrapping this up in the next few months and having action items to bring back so we have a plan in motion. So it doesn't hang out there. We'll have a plan and timelines attached for everyone's budget to know there's a resolution.
Okay.
final resolution of the last pieces.
But I wanted to hear.
Coming together, yes. Yeah. So the signage is working, you know, some of the new enforcement protocols are working, the notifications to the island walk business owners, we've identified through the help of our residents, truck companies that have been notified to stop traveling through. We've notified the mapping companies. All those things are working and starting to show fruit and be successful. And so to your point, getting a timeline and finishing these elements up, I think, is going to really hopefully get us that impact we're hoping to see.
And those are those goals I was talking about, you know, just saying, okay, now we've completed this goal, let's move on to the other goal. I understand funding is always going to be the discussion that we have to have. However, we have this as part of our strategic action plan and identified this as a priority. So I don't want it out there lingering.
Yes.
I think we've gone through the process, engaged the impacted residents, the surrounding residents, have come up with short-term strategies, long-term strategies, but I'd like a timeline identified so we keep moving forward.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much. Okay. Agenda item number 5 is a presentation and discussion of options to regulate small box retail stores. Who will be?
We have Jason. With a presentation and a timeline of future events.
Okay, good morning again.
Morning.
So here's a little background on where we are so far, and we apologize for being a little confusing because our timeline is so condensed that we have stuff overlapping. So you'll remember that we had the legislation in progress. You approved on January the 14th, which set the 120-day clock starting, which ends on May the 13th. February 19th, the Planning Board voted to approve or recommend the moratorium. And then last week, on first reading, you approved the moratorium ordinance itself, which was the second step after the legislation in progress. So we know some nationwide data regarding small box retail. There's been a rapid growth in numbers. The two largest retailers say they plan to build another 20,000 more of them nationwide in the near future, and that 75% of these are in towns of 20,000 or fewer people. We also have some studies that were done nationwide that suggest that these types of establishments can close grocery stores or eliminate jobs and erode the opportunity for fresh food. They generally saturate an area or cluster in an area, which can cause difficulties for grocery stores opening in a particular area. And although there are some prototypes for these types of establishments having fresh food in general, they do not offer fresh food and they're a poor substitute for a grocery store. Some of the other studies include that because of the nature of them, a smaller retailer, they create fewer jobs and they have lower wages compared to a grocery store. It makes it difficult for folks to get access to fresh food when they're clustered in a particular area. And it has an adverse effect on mom and pops as the profits go to the corporate offices and out of the community. Some of the communities have addressed small box retail, and Kansas City and Mesquite, Texas both put some land use controls on it. Kansas City requires a special use permit for all zoning districts, and Mesquite has a conditional use, which goes to some performance measures that they require, which we'll see in a moment. Some other cities have put separation requirements between them, ranging from a mile to 2 miles.
And like I said, some have put in required performance measures where no outdoor displaying or an area, a particular amount of the floor area has to be reserved for fresh meats, fruits, or produce. Now, Ray's going to take over and tell you about the conditions that we have with our small box retailers right now in the city and commercial zoning, and then some next steps.
Good morning, council members. Looking at Palm Coast, right now we do have six of these small boxes. One is located in the neighborhood commercial. Let me just back up. City of Palm Coast, as far as commercial zoning districts, we have three of them. One we call COM 1, which is your neighborhood commercial. Then we have COM 2, which is your kind of medium intensity commercial. And then we have COM 3, commercial 3, which is a high intensity commercial. So not all zoning districts are the same.
Give an example of what could be in COM 1, COM 2, or COM 3.
Well, I'll give you a good example of what I've heard through some of the public comments, okay? Let's take gas station. You know, we have heard that, comparing the small box, you allow gas stations. Well, we have protections in our code that provides for limitations of those gas stations. It's not apples to apples. For example, a good example would be if you go down Clubhouse Drive and you see the Shell gas station. That is a neighborhood commercial gas station. It has two pump islands, very limited, in that design. And if you go down State Road 100 and you see Racetrack and you see whatever, how many pumps they have, 20 or 24 or 25.
That. So you just said that.
Okay?
Yes.
So you have limitations. You're not going to see the racetrack on State Road 100 in the middle of the neighborhood. So basically what we do is, you have specific uses that are more geared towards neighborhood commercial, and you have those uses or commercial uses that are geared more towards high intensity. Now, when we became a city, a lot of times we did inherit some of the zoning and that, that is currently in the city that we put, the commercial zoning district. We try to do our best with what we had to make it more appropriate for neighborhood commercial, the high intensity commercial, or the medium commercial. So it's important to point that out, that we're not just talking one commercial zoning district within the city office.
So then the COM 2, could they be located in neighborhoods, or COM 3, or no? They're just located in commercial corridors?
Yeah, typically, again, we were inherited some of the medium commercial, and we did the zoning in 2008, and actually 2008 when we did our code and made it consistent with comp plan. Sometimes, the county had, limited commercial, high intensity commercial as well, so we had to take what we had to put it there. But in general, Mayor, yes, you can see some of the neighborhood commercials are geared around those neighborhood areas as well. So, we do have those that are located in our general commercial, again, our COM 2 and 3 within a master plan development agreement. And as you all know, that is a negotiated development agreement that is provided to City Council via the ordinance. Yeah, and our separation that we have, it ranges from just a little over half mile to 4.5 miles. And Town Center is the closest where we have two, and that's a master plan development where it's just a little over a half mile separation.
And so is Family Dollar, are they all like considered dollar something?
Yeah, okay. They would be considered small boxes.
Okay, and so...
the definition we established for a small box is less than 16,000 square feet and generally having items that are less, cost less than they would in a full price establishment.
And then but the other cities that have looked at this and viewed this and said the separation is something that they think makes sense because of the fact that they come in with several LLCs and try to just monopolize the market in a way that, because they fit into that more, that scope, they can do that.
Yeah, and I think it's the proliferation or the clustering of those to have some sort of separation. And separation in ordinances is not uncommon. I mean, even in the city of Palm Coast, we have separation and we follow state law with community residential homes, for example, where you know, you don't want them right, you know, next to each other. And that's a state law. We've done separations via an ordinance before city council when we did the pill mill, you know, we provided separation. That's also in state law as well. So it's not uncommon to have some separation for specific uses. And then, so we, you know, kind of came up with some options, kind of a list, so to speak. So, you know, option one would be not to make any changes. Option two is, you know, some of the history and looking at some of the case studies of other municipalities is limited to a particular zoning district. Again, you know, do we want to limit these type of uses in our neighborhood commercial? If you do allow them in our neighborhood commercials, maybe you want to put a special exception. And what a special exception is it's within our land development code. A special exception would require a public hearing, public meeting with our Planning and Land Development Regulations Board. And basically, a special exception is a use that may or may not be compatible with that specific area. So it's on a case-by-case basis where that special exception would go to the Planning Board. We follow specific criteria. The adjoining properties are notified, and the Planning Board has a right to put on specific conditions. For example, when we had the neighborhood, the BP gas station on Clubhouse Drive, for example, I think went through a special exception years ago, went to the Planning Board. One of the special conditions, because you have a neighborhood in the back, they have a special condition to approve it, subject to they make a larger buffer, put more plants in the back of that use to make it more compatible with that neighborhood. So that's what a special exception can
so, be. So, you know, using this as an example then, would a special exception make sense if there are a small box store that's looking at coming in to a neighborhood, but it impacts the traffic or the trucks coming in, the requirements, like the flow of that? Would that be an impediment that you would evaluate to say, you know, this may not make sense in this part of our community because we already have other issues going on?
They can. They can, based on technical and staff. Of course, before we go to the Planning Board, we're going to do that analysis. We're going to do that transportation analysis. We're going to do that health and safety analysis. And they can add, you know, for example, some of the auto parts stores that have gone through special exceptions. The Planning Board has made recommendations such as not doing repairs in the parking lot. So they can add that. They'll get our technical data, and the Planning Board has even done hours of operation as well for some of these uses for special exceptions. The goal is to make it as compatible with the surrounding area as much as possible.
And I think that speaks to that quality of life we were talking about before, neighborhoods. I mean, when there's an expectation that is there, that sort of rises the occasion of saying, you know, how is that going to impact that neighborhood? Is it going to be a positive impact? Is it going to be, you know, is it going to be hours of operation where they're operating it, closing at 10 o'clock at night and lights are on? I mean, to me, I think that's important that we get a better understanding and really talk about that.
Exactly, and that's another component that you have utilized in special exception, shielding of lighting if you're next to a neighbor for that BP, for example.
Okay.
limit small box retail to just comp two and more
so
intense
located
commercials.
Where?
Primarily on arterials.
Yeah.
Okay, like the sort of that.
Concourse Parkway,
State Route 100. Yeah.
Okay.
major corridor.
Which is there? It's where they are now.
It's there now, right. Yeah,
it's where they're at now.
Mm-hmm. And then special exception in all zoning district. That could be a choice, too, as well for these uses. And the last one is the master plan development. What the choice is that it must specifically allow. And I'm going to try to explain this. When someone comes in with a development agreement, a lot of times what they'll do, let's say Palm Coast Park or town center, or let's take Palm Coast Park, the one on US 1. They will do a master plan and dig and kind of talk about these planning areas and specific areas of Palm Coast Park. And what they'll use is they'll use our zoning classification of COM 1, COM 2, COM 3. Let's just take commercial zoning. And they'll put in a specific area, this could be COM 1 uses of our land development code. This could be COM 2 uses of our land development code. So, for example, if council decides to prohibit it in neighborhood commercial, if a master plan development agreement shows that COM 1 here is on their plan, they would not be permitted there. On the other hand, we have very limited master plan development agreements that actually make copies of our zoning code and classifications and incorporate that into the development agreement. Those would still be allowed to have a COM 1. Okay? But moving forward, if we do a master plan development agreement, what we're saying too, if they, you know, because it's via an ordinance to specifically, you know, illustrate where that use would be.
Because as you see, we have three in an MPD already, and MPDs can create additional COM 1 that we don't currently have mapped. So if you decide to go something, we feel like that we should make sure we address it in MPD as well.
Where did you get the definition for small blocks for this analysis, Jason? Is that something we've adapted from other?
Yes, there were several cities that had it, and then we adjusted it to make sure it could fit our community.
Less than 60,000.
And they range between 8,500. The ones that we currently have range between 8,500 and 10,500.
I see. What's the difference between this definition and a Hallmark store, or this definition and a store of the square footage that sells pet supplies?
If you
can sell pet supplies, but you have to charge full price. Is that what we're talking
about?
Yeah,
and there's we actually write in some particulars into it, and we discussed the Hallmark store as part of that because we were concerned that we could catch them by mistake, and so we in the specifics of the definition. I'm sorry, I don't have it handy. We did add some language to protect from those types of uses.
Jason, if I could help, Councilman Huff, the definition that you're referring to says small box discount stores does not include a pharmacy, does not sell gasoline or diesel fuel, or specialty items and food items as a primary product, with examples, greeting cards, consignment, meat, seafood. Those are just examples, not inclusive, cheese, oils, or vinegar. So that is trying to make sure we don't catch unintended consequences.
What's the typical, if you know, square footage for the CVSs and the Walgreens that we have all over town?
Mm-hmm.
14. So the difference between what we're talking about regulating here and what everybody thinks of nowadays as a pharmacy is the pharmacies don't sell as much of their junk at discount as these stores do. I mean, I don't mean to sound sarcastic or skeptical, but I mean, I'll defer to our experts on this, but this seems like an awfully vague definition. I mean, it's like obscenity. Everybody knows what we're talking about, but I'm not.
If we did not have the sentence in there that I just read, then I would absolutely agree with you, Councilmember Cupp, that it would be very difficult to enforce this with the first part of that. The first part was to try to create a general statement of what we're trying to regulate, and the second sentence was to exclude out what we don't specifically want to regulate.
Too, when we had the medical marijuana discussion, I don't remember where
Do we place those specifically on our commercial corridors?
Higher intensity.
Is that what
higher
it was?
Intensity than commercial, yeah.
But they were also, we were limited in what we could do by the state statute. So we had to treat them exactly as we would treat pharmacies. That's what the state statute
Yeah, what we did is we also, you know, changed the definition of pharmacy as well.
Okay.
For that, that was one of the strategies that
we didn't have complete flexibility in this specific situation. Whereas here, there's no state preemption. There's no necessarily state regulation that we've got to tailor our definition to or our regulations.
Okay.
Yeah. So, is the ideal situation here? We've all encountered this. There are two very drastic, polar opposite opinions on these small box stores in certain areas of our city. Does applying a special exemption in neighborhood commercial districts at least allow the opportunity for our residents to be able to voice their opinion and gives them the opportunity to at least speak at some of our planning meetings to just ensure that they are getting their sentiment across? I feel like prohibiting them across the board wouldn't necessarily satisfy both of those polar opposite opinions or views on these small box stores. But in my, the way I'm thinking is that at least a special exemption allows the opportunity for these individuals who feel passionately one way or the other an opportunity to speak at least. I'm sure everyone on this council has seen and heard both ends of the spectrum of opinion on this.
Let me jump in. And I know, Ray, you want to say something?
Yeah, I was just going to, you know, I want to emphasize that the special exception is not the same as a rezoning where you're notified 300 feet. Mm-hmm. It is the adjoining property owners on a special exception. So.
Okay, so anyone from outside of the zone would not be able to speak? Is that true?
Well, they can, but a letter goes out for special exception
sure.
to the abutting.
Understood.
So it won't be really.
Public hearing, anyone can speak.
Exactly.
But yeah,
and that's really more or less what I'm trying to get at least we're creating that opportunity to facilitate that conversation.
But what I wanted to say, just to put a finer point on this, the process of a special exception. Special exception hearing, like any other quasi-judicial hearing, is not a matter of pure democracy where it's just a raising of hands and those that like them win, or you know, if they've got more hands raised. Like rezonings, like conditional uses, yeah. it's tailored to address the policy concerns for that particular type of request for that application for development order. And in this case, from what I've heard and from what we've studied, is that you've got different concerns that would apply to these types of hearings, quasi-judicial hearings for these small box stores. One would be the issue about the impact on grocery stores and the food availability. That is a legitimate public policy concern, and that would be part of the test and the study for these public hearings. And the other is neighborhood concerns, which we talked about earlier. Traffic, impact on a small insular neighborhood and getting a commercial, this type of commercial use in there. Those would be the factors that the PLDR would need to consider in making their quasi-judicial decision.
I just want to ensure that I completely understand that the law has to be applied and that this isn't a matter of like a democratic vote where more people want to question first don't, but at least this creates the opportunity for them to relay their sentiment.
Absolutely.
And in a real world application, even though technically, which is the best way to be right, but technically they would still be able to, this be allowed in certain situations if the exception was not met, that at least the sentiment could be relayed and hopefully consumed by the entity that is going to be pursuing development of the parcel.
Yeah, I think, you know, remember how this conversation first came about. It was just the moratorium took place because we wanted to take a step back because our community changed. Shopping patterns changed, business strategies changed, and it did impact, sort of how we view residential neighborhoods, the impact that it creates. We just went through, how many years of discussion on Florida Park Drive. I would hate to have an impact that would compound the traffic on Florida Park Drive, and that could potentially happen if you don't look at this and view this, at least acknowledge it. So, I remember a time when Linear Park was to be developed as a strip mall. If you think about driving on Palm Coast Parkway today with the canopy and how beautiful that is, I always tell the story, my father was very interested in saving that and making it Lanier Park, was the fact that we would be looking at a parking lot today, driving on Palm Coast Parkway, that forever changes that landscape. And we have one chance to get this right. And I want to make sure we're evaluating it based on what our residents are saying to us, how important their quality of life is, how the market has driven certain stores to have a strategy to grow exponentially because they can. And I think it's important that we evaluate it and say, you know, do we want to have an empty strip mall in the middle of an area of our neighborhood that if the market does change again, you know, I think eventually fuel is going to change, right? So that's why I like the fact that you're saying in the neighborhood it's only two gas pumps rather than hope, you know, I think at one point there'll be electric stations in most places. So to be able to pivot and go in that direction I think is important, and this certainly would allow us to do that.
Also about the cluster, no doubt about it. I believe it or not, I don't like to call it a moratorium. I'd rather call it a grace period to let us elucidate ourselves about what's going on. Nobody is trying to hurt any business. Nobody is trying to hurt real estate or anybody. We're trying to do what's best for the city. That's why we study these things. Okay. And today was very enlightening, certain things that I heard. And I'm going to take them into consideration next time we have to vote on this. And I'm going to really look deeper and deeper into this, as we all should. Okay, but as to do with cluster, and once again, I refer to my background. When you come from certain places where these things proliferate like there's no tomorrow, that does not bring a lot good for the neighbors. But then again, who am I to say, no, you can't build or cannot? That's why I listen to you. That's why I listen to the people, and I make my decisions. Okay, but the cluster has a lot to do with it. So arteries, in my opinion, should be the main areas for these things. When you call them commercial one, commercial two, commercial three, I mean, the special exception, when you really talk, you're not talking to the residents, I understand you're talking with adjacent properties.
Could be residents.
And the residents. Okay. Not wrong.
So to Vice Mayor Clerk's point then, what would be a policy or... you know, some type of regulation that we put in place that would allow for that impact in that neighborhood to certainly be heard and voiced. I mean, they can speak at any public hearing, but does something trigger it to allow it to be more formal?
Well, I think if I could, without saying the specifics, I think that you put, in order to develop the appropriate specifics, we have to identify what it is, what public policy we're trying to achieve. What are we trying to protect? Trying to protect these neighborhoods, we're trying to make sure that these neighborhoods have access to a legitimate source of groceries and fresh food and that sort of thing. That's one of the things that has legally justified these types of regulations in other jurisdictions. So if you've got a neighborhood and these start to proliferate and you have a lot of these stores, then there could be impacts. So the specific regulations that the members of the PLD would look at is what is in that general area already? And if this turns out to be a small box store, there's multiple store box stores, what's going to be the impact on that community, not just the next door neighbors, but the community, and then getting drilling a little bit deeper, on the specific building, the specific use, will it have an impact on traffic? Will it have an impact on noise and those other things? Now, I'm not a planner, they are, but from a legal standpoint, those are things that I would be looking for when the planners come back and provide to my office what we're looking
for. And so that slowdown that you refer to, or that regroup or rethought, whatever, you know, moratorium is the legal basis for, you know, what we're allowed to do.
Called grace period.
Yes, the grace period. You know, we can state, you know, today, you know, why are you addressing an issue that may not be an issue today? Now is the perfect time to address the issue before it becomes an issue. So I really do want to get a full understanding of, you know, what we're talking about and where they're currently zoned. It could have a material impact in certain neighborhoods when we're trying to address
other issues that have been out of our control, and for some time now. We're trying to address them by investing money into those, investing different resources into those, and it's taken us a lot of time to evaluate this. So if you look at how Palm Coast was designed and set up, again, it's changed over time because of different shopping and options and opportunities. So I'm appreciative of taking this time, and I want to look back on this moment and say to our residents, we took the appropriate amount of time, and this was a thoughtful discussion, and we want to make sure that we are valuing you as residents and the neighborhoods in which you decided to invest in, and we don't want to take away from that experience for you, and we think that there's something afoot that will do that.
My concern on this is that we now have the tools that we can direct and allow General Dollar, let's say, or Family Dollar Tree or wherever, to go in a place where we want them to go if it's going to impact on some other. We have those tools that you just showed under option two. I just don't want to see us say, well, there'll be no more General Dollar stores here.
I don't think anybody wants that.
But see, that's been some of the feedback I've been getting, as a perception. I said, well, wait a minute. That's not the intent on this thing here. We just want to make sure that we've got some tools. Because the last thing we want to do is say, well, we're going to have this moratorium, yet we're business friendly. And those two are incongruent when you use those terms together. I just want to make sure, and you put it out there and under option two, we have the controls to allow them to go where we want them to go because we feel it's in the best interest of our community.
I will tell you, Councilman, that has always been my intention, is to evaluate to say what is appropriate. Let's take a pause, a moment to evaluate it. And I've never been, to ban them outright. I've never said this is not, at all appropriate in any place in our community. I'm just saying where it's appropriate. We've done it with the pill mills. We've done it with medical marijuana. We've done it historically with the gamble. We're doing it with your vaping,
Right.
I mean, we're saying
right.
We want to be in control of this moment. And we have the ability to do that. So let's do that.
I agree with it, but sometimes, though, perception.
Yeah,
that's the evil thing,
I'm very well aware of perception.
Perception.
And then reality.
Yeah. Right. Okay, well, we're good then.
Like some other communities, we have some options for you for separation. If you think that's important, then we can include that. And then some performance measures as well, options like other communities have done with requiring a specific amount of floor space towards fresh foods and limiting outdoor displays. So we've kind of put it in a table here for you so you can kind of, this is a la carte. You can select from the zoning perspective, the separation perspective, the performance perspective, what you would like to see us bring back to you in an ordinance, and those are the different ones that we outlined originally.
I want to look into this a little deeper, so I want to meet with you guys. I want to really, really do a little looking into this deeper. It's a big decision we're taking over here.
And we'll take one and a half, two months.
We have to be careful.
Yeah,
we really
do.
We really have to be careful. We don't want to hurt anybody. But then again, we have to protect this city. That's what we're doing. That's why we're taking big grace period.
Right.
Whatever you want to call it, I call it a grace period. I want to eliminate myself about these things. And until I'm sure, when I'm going to have a vote this important, until I'm sure, I'm going to make sure that I'm sure.
Yeah.
All right.
Council Mayor, I want to know one point from a timing standpoint. Staff and your legal department were very clear that we wanted to have an appropriate amount of time to do the work, to do the study, so that we can have the background necessary legally if we were going to go forward and change our land development code in some way. But we didn't want to create an imposition on the businesses and the community. So we chose a 120-day moratorium as what we felt was appropriate to balance those two objectives. And that started with on January 14th with the original resolution. That ends on May 13th. So one of the things that we're looking for today is direction. And so we don't, you know, we don't have to get it today per se, but if we're going to be able to draft something to take to PLDRB and then for an ordinance to amend the land development code, we will need to receive that direction soon. I guess that's the point I'm trying to make. Well, unless, if you want to get it in place, these regulations, assuming that's what you want to do, in place by the end of the moratorium, which is May 13th. And today's the 10th of March, and it just goes by so fast.
Mayor, our next planning board meeting is next Wednesday. And we cannot make May 13th unless we're on the planning board next week. Now, the moratorium ordinance that you passed on first reading allows for a 30-day extension, so we could push it out to the April planning board if you would like, but because this is a land use change, it has to go to planning board.
I would prefer to do that, frankly. I would like the planning board to also have input on this. We've appointed them to make recommendations to us. I think having more the public dialogue and discussion is important, and then having us take the time required. So I'm in favor of this.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
We're going to be having second reading on the moratorium, I believe, at the next business meeting.
That's correct.
So we'll have that ordinance in place, and when it's in place, that will then give us the power to extend the moratorium for 30 more days to achieve the objectives that we've been discussing in the workshop this morning.
Thank you.
And then would you like us to come back at your next workshop to receive direction, or how would you?
No, I mean, I think you have direction. We're going to extend it, and then what we will do is we will all take our time required, and we will go through the options that you've offered, and I think we can probably put it on the next workshop, since we've eliminated one of them, to state this is really where we feel we are as a council. And then you can get consensus to then move on to the business aspect.
Okay, thank you.
And we'll want the input too from the planning board.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Did you want something from?
Well, now if we're going to do it again, we'll do it all at once. I was going to say that from my perspective, the whole issue of fresh food and food deserts is a complete non-starter here in Palm Coast. And I mean, personally, or as a council member, I would support a regulation telling Dollar General they have to have 10% of their floor area devoted to fresh food when there's a half a dozen small ethnic grocery stores along Palm Coast Parkway, or we've got a Walmart or Aldi's or whatever popping up, it seems like everywhere. I mean, we've got to start narrowing our choices, and I mean, to me, trying to justify this on the basis that we're getting a food desert in a city like Palm Coast is just, I think that's a stretch, or it's a leap too far for me. I mean, some of the other stuff about COM 1, COM 2, special exception, maybe some type of distance regulation to make sure that these aren't on four corners. But, you know, then when I say that and you drive through half the cities in this area of the country, and on the southeast corner you have a Walgreens at maybe 14,000 square feet, and on the diagonally opposite corner you have a CVS at 14,000 square feet. That makes no sense to me, but it obviously makes sense to CVS and Walgreens. And
I think that's also, though, where it's located in COM. Like, for me, it's much more about the impact on the neighborhood.
Yeah, so, I mean, something looking at the different zoning districts is one thing, but in terms of claiming that we're doing this to prevent a food desert in Palm Coast, I mean, I know we have food insecurity in this community. All you have to do is go down to the food bank distributions on the weekend and see the traffic backing up out of the US 1. I'm not arguing that we don't have that, but we do not have a food desert. So that's just my two cents as far as direction of staff. But
so I think we all concur with your statements. I think this is much more about the neighborhoods. That's the sense I'm getting from everyone's conversation.
Yeah.
So I think you have clear direction on focusing on that aspect of it.
Thank you, Council.
Thank you. Oh, okay.
It's only been 2 hours.
Well, that's just the perfect time because I do know we've got
Yes.
So, council lunch is being served in the room adjacent to us. Let's take a 15-minute break. I'd like to call this meeting back to order. Hopefully we'll have other council members join us. We'll now move to agenda item number 6, which is a discussion of city manager evaluation process.
Thank you, Mayor, City Council. It is time to evaluate the performance, my performance for the first year. It's supposed to be a collaborative process. To that end, what I did is a suggestion, and you guys can obviously take the discussion wherever you want. Provided in your packet, I think a very comprehensive survey that gets at the heart of what the functions, I think the city manager's role, specifically for the city of Palm Coast, also provides for those narrative questions for comments. For administrative purposes, if you did not know, Helena Alves is my boss at City Hall, and so I would propose that she would actually coordinate with Virginia to run that process. Have you fill out that survey, give it to Virginia. Helena can do two things. Again, in my mind that I envision, she would individually put them in a notebook and then combine the results, using an average formula, because you're all going to check some boxes and write some narrative questions, and then schedule, I'm guessing, in April, an opportunity for after you've had time to review it individually and come back to a workshop or meeting and conduct a formal discussion on an evaluation. So unless there's a different idea of how you envision this process working, or format, or method. That's what we are bringing to you today.
So I think I am pleased that we will have a formal process, because we did not historically have a formal process. So thank you for being a city manager that welcomes a public discussion by your five bosses. I think that's important to the public to hear. I think that's important for each of us to hear. It's speak to each other. It's a public setting. Because of that transparency, hopefully it gives you now a moment to reflect on that evaluation and different areas that, maybe you can improve or maybe you can address. And so I am very much in support of this. I'm also in support of having it gathered by Helena in independent of you and putting it on the agenda for discussion. Does any other council members have
just
any thoughts?
I think it's a good process, even though I can talk to her face if I don't like something, but I still have to tell the people out there, and that's one way of doing it is by evaluating it publicly. Which I will do gladly.
That wasn't at all intimidating.
I remember the day I.
You got the hammer, but I got the mouth.
I remember the day I signed the employment agreement. I got a call, I think, from Mr. Ronquillo, and said, "I'm going to make your life pleasantly miserable."
But that.
Yes, thank
I'll
you.
Make your life.
All right, well, we'll move that forward.
Pleasantly miserable.
Thank you very much.
No good deed goes unpunished.
That's right. It's just a sacred quote.
Did council have any input on the survey itself, or did you want to add anything or amend anything to the language that you think would be valuable?
I think as long as it's all compiled and transpiled correctly so that we can get it in front of us and see the compilation of all of our views, I think that's the best way to handle it.
That was easy. Okay. So Helena will be managing this process. Okay.
I'll stay on
that. Sorry.
That's okay.
And then agenda item number F are written items. Agenda item number 7 is a resolution approving the auditor selection procedure for selection of an external auditing firm.
So thank you, Mayor Council. It is time again to approve an external auditing firm. I should say select and then review and approve an external auditing firm. This new document and this new request to look for an auditor was, in fact, compiled and vetted through Helena to take into account the new
updates the Florida statute, and this will allow for selection procedures for the external auditing firm that are in compliance with that. It does meet all the statutory requirements. As you know, you as the city council ultimately serve as the auditor selection committee. You will select the best qualified public accounting firm to perform these annual financial audits. It will be a public vetted process, and we'll come back to you. So today what we're asking for, in essence, is the resolution that will authorize the search process to begin and allow us to post the request or proposals to have a new auditing team or auditing group come in to serve the city's financial auditor.
How many years have we had the same auditor? I'm just curious.
I believe it started in 2004, if I'm not mistaken. So it's a 3-year contract with 2 1-year renewals.
Because I know we're meeting with them this year to discuss the auditor recommendation findings. So
yes.
This will be for next year.
Yes.
Okay.
So typically we wait until they present the audit reports before we actually go out for RFP for a new contract. So they will be coming before City Council at the business meeting of the 17th to present the audit results. And then basically starting in April, my procurement staff would be posting the RFP and then managing the mechanics behind it on behalf of City Council.
I'm just curious, Helena, what do you typically look for in an auditor to audit government? I mean, that's a particular, I assume, specialty.
Yes, and they are required to fulfill certain areas of expertise as per the Auditor General guidelines. But it's important that they have the experience, that they have a presence, also, so we don't necessarily want a firm that is so far outside of our city area because it becomes hard to schedule, you know, meetings and for them to know really what goes on in our community, that type of thing, and experience and resources. Because if they don't have the necessary resources to dedicate to our audit, it delays the whole process.
Okay. Council, any questions on this item? Look forward to it. Thank you. Agenda item number F8 is a resolution approving a federally funded sub-award and grant agreement with Florida Department of Emergency Management relating to Hurricane Dorian expenses. One of our favorite topics known to mankind.
Yes.
So we have about $250,000 roughly in requests for reimbursement for the Hurricane Dorian training exercise. Of course, the Department of Homeland Security designates the Florida Department of Emergency Management as they get the funds and disperse those. So this sub-award agreement allows us to begin that application process and agree to apply for and receive funds from FDEM for Dorian reimbursements.
And we've been made whole from the previous two storms.
90%?
Yes. We're over 90% collected for both storms. We're within 75,000 of our $2.5 million goal in the disaster reserve fund. The items that are left now are closeout, and my understanding is that closeout takes a few years. Yes.
Leave it to the federal government to
for them
slow
to do everything that they need to do. But yes, we are at 90% collected on the other hurricanes. This one, same philosophy as before. We try to get reimbursement for as much as possible.
So let me ask you, the company that we hire, that third party that normally comes in, if indeed this happened in Jacksonville, years later, FEMA comes in and takes the money back, takes a portion of it back, because they don't feel like, for some reason, they didn't feel like Jacksonville, the money that they received with reimbursements, some of them were deemed unqualified. Does that company then be held responsible that we hired to do that?
I believe they're consultants to help us get to the numbers, but their responsibility, I believe, remains with the city. What a lot of governments have done for their financial audit process is that they put a disclaimer that, of course, the costs are anticipated. Even though if they are collected, they could be adjusted later on. But we go through a pretty thorough review process, so hopefully if they have adjustments, it wouldn't be anything significant. Okay.
Mayor, I think there could be two factors. One is the actual agreement between the city of Jacksonville and this contractor. Secondly, if there were disagreements and they weren't specified in the contract, then I think we'd turn on exactly why the money was taken back by the federal government and whether that was something that the contractor didn't do right, or it might have been something the city of Jacksonville just didn't document correctly.
Okay.
That's just hard to tell.
I just want to make sure we're safeguarding everything when it comes to these dollars, especially because, you know, we replaced or replenished the fund, and I would hate to see us being caught off guard years from now.
Mm-hmm.
With it being
there's never a guarantee when it comes to FEMA, but
yeah.
We do put it through a pretty thorough review.
Yeah.
But I'm happy to say we're getting to that $2.5 million.
That's right. Thank you so much. Agenda item number F9 is a resolution approving the submission of Florida Inland Navigational District Waterways Assistance Program application for water access.
So thank you, Alderman, Council. Carl's going to come up to give us some background and help, but we have a very unique and timely opportunity to apply for a fine grant to improve water access at Waterfront Park. It was part of the original master plan. And Carl, I know are you going to pull up
anticipated image?
There somewhere.
They're somewhere. So
I am pleased that we're finally applying for a FIND grant after a few years of taking time off.
I was just going to say it's a timely opportunity, significant amount of money that helps advance. That's why we're applying. It does require 50% match, but the amount that would help advance the CIP, advance our parks master plan and our amenities is significant, to the tune of $350,000 if we're successful with FIND. So that is great. And again, does continue to build on the approved plan for Waterfront Park to allow enhanced access to the waterway.
Right.
Access. Yes.
Yeah, so this shows kind of an overall aerial of Waterfront Park site. As indicated, there was a master plan down that showed boat access into the intracoastal waterway. When the initial construction was completed, it was also done through a fine grant. And there was only certain elements built. The boat access piece was not built at that time. We do have a concept plan here that we're looking at providing some boat access with additional parking and staging areas and whatnot to get into the water. We obviously would phase these improvements to best utilize the fine grant application because there is limited funds in the fine. So this shows an overall plan. We wouldn't be constructing everything that's shown kind of in yellow here in this initial phase. We would obviously start with the access elements into the waterway and then work backwards from there. So there may be subsequent years where we come back to you with an additional request to submit more applications for fine to complete all the improvements.
And we feel comfortable with the current match request. Again, by moving some projects around, can we accommodate an existing budget? And the benefit of doing that, again, is to take advantage of, rather than just a straight capital project, we're writing a check, a significant amount of match available here through FIND to help accelerate this project with grant dollars. And you know the need as well as I do. The day we were out on site walking the project and looking around, there's multi-use, there's water access, there's bikers and walkers and bird watchers, fishers, and obviously this is a tremendously well-used park. So the access and the long-term phasing of the parking is a great improvement.
Especially for good for like a kayak launch there. You see a lot of kayakers utilize that as well. So I would say, council, every year, the FIND board that's the governor appoints comes in and does a community outreach. And in April, they will be doing a community outreach in advance of the grant process to begin over at Captain's Barbecue. I think each of you will be getting invitations from Mayor Netz, who serves as our representative for Flagler County. I would encourage each of us to go and hopefully introduce this project to the FIND board members that will be making this decision in our community. They will be scoring and ranking the grant applications. What happens with FIND dollars, our community pays in on their tax bill a portion of FIND dollars that go in to an overall budget. The process has always been is what the community pays in, the community is allowed to apply for annually. and the requirement is a 50-50 match. And so our community, primarily Palm Coast residents, they've generated in revenue, I think it's around $350,000 a year. And so we haven't always applied for those funds, but that is what our community has actually invested in. And if we don't apply for the funds, they get swept into a state fund for dredging. So we're not even taking advantage of a local grant that our residents are paying for, and other communities benefiting from that dredging. So I encourage you to reach out to the board members, support this project. Again, it's a public access launch of kayaking, and it's a great addition to our amenity of Waterfront Park. And you know, we're not wasting an opportunity with these dollars. Thank you so much for all your work on this, Carl. I appreciate it. Okay, agenda item number F10 is a resolution approving a contract, Halifax Paving, for the Old Kings Road Widening Phase 1 project.
So this is a project that's been in the works for quite some time. We are actually ready to move forward with the first phase of widening Old Kings Road, which actually starts a little bit south of Palm Coast Parkway. I have an aerial map that kind of shows in blue the rough extents of the project limits. So it basically starts on Palm Coast Parkway, goes up, you know, to the bowling alley, basically, and it's going to widen that area, add some dedicated turn lanes, really improve the intersection of Palm Coast Parkway, have that function much better than it does today. The item that you have today, there's really lots of parts to it because there's a multitude of contracts that we'll have to do to move forward. The first one, I guess to start off, it's a DOT-funded project. So we received dollars from DOT. The bids came in actually under budget, which is good, excellent news. So the DOT dollars will pay for all the construction costs of the project. There will be some costs as well for CEI services, which they will fund as well. So we have a contract to award construction to Halifax Paving, who is the contractor. The city went through an advertising process through CCNA and selected an engineering firm to do CEI services, construction, engineering, and inspection during the construction phase. It's required by DOT, the requirement that we do that. So we picked the most qualified firm, negotiated a scope and fee, so those fees are in there as well. GAI Consultants is in there as a selected firm to handle those services, so there's a contract item for you to approve with them. Then we have some agreements with FPL to do street lighting, so we'll be lighting the street lighting with this project as well. Halifax will be installing the conduit as part of their work, and then FPL will come and pull the wire and set the poles. There's a lot of upfront costs with FPL on this one, because to install the streetlights, they have to add some inline transmission poles. They're finalizing their design right now, but it's about $150,000. But DOT is going to cover that upfront cost.
Great.
As part of the grant.
So those are all LED lights, correct?
Will all be LED, correct. So we'll have some additional, so they're looking for council approval for a city to execute these agreements when they do get formalized and the final dollars get negotiated with FPL. So that'll be one item. Then we have some fiber throughout this project as well. So in the contract, Halifax will be installing some conduit for the fiber. We'll have to do some upfront work to backfeed some existing customers and then run the new fiber through the system. So we have a contract with Danella, who does a lot of our fiber work in town, to do that work.
That's fantastic.
And then we have a contingency approval for a 10% contingency in here as well. And I think that covers all the items.
So when you're going through this discussion, I guess, you know, you're timing it out. Who does sort of like the traffic control? I mean, how is that going to work?
This is, as part of the upfront design, we do a MO, maintenance of traffic plan, so there's multiple phases. So we basically tell the contractor how we want to do lane closures and the timing of that. of those various phases. So we're reviewing that up front so the contractor can't, he knows what to expect and what he needs to plan for. He can't do a full shutdown or shut down two lanes or one lane. We kind of strategize and minimize the impact of traffic. There, obviously, there's going to be some disruption. It's a very tech corridor, lots and lots of utilities, ATT, all the various utility companies in here have to move their stuff out of the way. So it's not just going to be us doing work in here. All the utilities are going to come in here and do work as well. So it's going to be a lot of activity. It's going to be roughly, you know, close to a year of impact. So we're looking to start in the spring here, possibly May, June timeframe. Construction will begin, but it'll be about a year long.
So it'd be great for us to work with the local businesses along this corridor that will be impacted. Maybe, Bob, you can hold the little town hall. Tell all your business neighbors.
Actually, probably going to get thrown out of my office. Okay. A couple of months.
Okay.
Maybe
we can work with
communication. Any other councilor want to take this?
What are you doing out there? Well, in advance, so they understand the scope and, you know, they understand the impact, especially if it's impacting businesses along this corridor. I think we want to make sure, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's, I'm sure I'm not the only one, but I drive that corridor, especially the northern half of it, four times a day on an average business day. It's a mess now, and I'm sure this isn't going to improve it until it's done, so...
Looking forward
to it being done.
It impacted the businesses on A1A in Pointe Beach when they were doing the whole road structure project, and so we just want to make sure we have a plan in place in advance of this.
Price of progress.
Yes. Yes. Well, thanks for the info, Bob.
Well,
I appreciate it.
Yeah, looking for some cheap space.
Nothing definite.
So okay. Thank you, Carl. Okay, so agenda item number 11 is a resolution approving a change order with Sheen Line LLC for structure 735517 as part of the trenchless pipe rehabilitation services project.
So this is today we have Carmelo Morales here. He's in the stormwater department, one of our engineers that oversees all our stormwater capital projects. So this is one of the projects that he managed, and I'm going to let him give you the background on this particular item.
Sure. Good afternoon. Right, so this particular project is one of six different culvert crossings that we've been doing. So far, we've completed five out of six, this being the one that's missing. The pipelining has various methods, if you will, where they have there's a slip lining type where they insert an HDPE pipe inside the old pipe and fill the edges. There is a cured in place type that's basically a liner, like it's hardened and it adheres itself to the old pipe. And then there is a spin casting method that, oddly enough, you saw a picture of earlier underneath his...
Carl was standing in the picture.
Yeah, it wasn't Carl. But who's to say? He had his face covered, right?
What's the lifespan of that when you do that?
It's basically like inserting a brand new pipe.
Okay.
In some of these cases, as much as 50 years. And the benefit of it really is that you limit the amount of demo that you have to do in rebuilding back the road. This particular one is of importance because it's on the east section, on the East Hampton Canal. And as you're probably aware, that's a one-way in, one-way out type of thing. So it's critical that we limit the disturbance through any of the traffic going on through there. And this particular one is also, the qualified bidder was the slip lining technique. So essentially we insert an HDPE pipe inside there. Now through a series of events, the challenge has come up that the pipe that actually needs to be inserted, it needs to be a little bit smaller, and the pipe that was purchased is larger, so it doesn't quite fit in there. So there's our challenge now. What do we do with that already purchased pipe that had some work done on it? So this is what the little presentation shows is. On the left,
I'm all right. The most chill.
Right. So here's our current location, right? These are our pipes that we need to line. This, by the way, is a little excerpt from DRMP, who is the engineer, the consultant engineer doing east section drainage improvements. It's still under design, currently being reviewed for permits. They had already recommended to replace this set of pipes down here. This is the crossing, kind of the rails and trails, if you will, the old easement through there. So we're going to take advantage of the situation of having a 72-inch pipe and utilize it for there, which we're going to do anyway. It's just kind of accelerating the process, if you will. So that's what we'll do out here. They recommended, you know, remove the CMP and utilize RCP, but HDPE is actually a DOT approved for roads. That's not a major.
You just said like six acronyms in 2 seconds.
I'm sorry. Boy, high density polyethylene.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
High density polyethylene. That's what the 72-inch pipe is made out of. It's basically like a PVC, like a plastic, a hard plastic, but it, the HDPE is a little more flexible. Just has a little more give. I apologize for that.
Here, I don't know if you remember. Councilmember DeStefano used to have a thing that she did not want any staff person to ever use an acronym. And so our meetings were a lot longer.
Well, yeah. I was going to say, I'm grateful that you just did that, because, I mean, it was just amazing how you did it.
I'm sorry. I'll try to limit that.
Now it's the language you speak. I get it.
Yes. Yeah. So one of the locations that we plan to utilize some of these pipes here, the other location is located in the F section. There is a ditch, this is the pipe crossing here. That crossing was installed when there's a trail also there, pedestrian, bicycle trail, multi-use path, and they inserted there, I don't know, maybe 10 or 14 years ago. I'm not sure how long that was. But this was also an area that was recommended for improvement. Coincidentally enough, it was also DRMP, the consultant that did the conceptual study in this area. They highlighted among several other culverts that one to be replaced with a 6x6 box culvert. In this case, we're utilizing a 72-inch pipe, so it's a little less than the area, but it provides better conveyance, if we will, because it's smooth surface versus concrete, it's more of a rough surface. So as far as flow is concerned, it's very similar. We modeled it basically, and the result yielded it was negligible, the difference between the two. Essentially, these are our proposed solutions as to what to do. And so the increase is to cover the cost of these pipes to be utilized for projects which we were planning to do anyway.
So any questions or comments on this agenda item? Well, thank you for all you do. Honestly, we appreciate someone that's so knowledgeable. No acronyms. So agenda item number 12 is a resolution approving a master price agreement with Harris Culvert Incorporated for the purchase of culvert pipes.
Are these the HDPE?
As well as the CMP on our guys. I think this is a contract that just recently expired. We just needed to renew. We used this vendor for many of our. As we progress through our maintenance project, there's pipes that need to get in place. And then this vendor, this is somebody that we've been utilizing, and we just buy the pipe. They provide unit costs, and I'm not sure the specifics how long this contract is going to go for, but it's a renewal.
It's one of our standard price agreements that we normally have. But
okay.
He said we use lots of pipe, we have to replace lots of pipe in the city. The last one, contract was up, we went back up to bid, and this is the new contract.
Right. Council, any questions or comments? Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Okay, we'll now move to agenda item number G, which is public participation. Any member of the public wish to make public comment? Please state your name for the record. Your 3 minutes will start.
Good afternoon. My name is Tony Amaral. I'm a 37-year resident here. Earlier today, you guys spoke about the park impact fees were discussed. As a local business that just happens to be a home builder also, I believe that the council has not had all the information needed at best, and possibly wrong information at worst, when it comes to making a 40-year decision on this park impact fees. When we met with staff, there were more questions than there were concrete answers in the methodology and the processes used. Your study does not account for any other revenues that are used to pay for these new parks, because all residents will use them, like the increase in ad valorem taxes, which will be going up, that's why we're building these parks to begin with, or grants, as was used in the past. Also, there's no account for existing parks or recreational areas in the county. So our level of service is way above and beyond our 8 acres that was in the land development. It does not factor in any growth in the next 3 to 4 months, or even the next 3 to 4 years, are going to be required to pay for a 40-year wish list. We always say, the council always says, growth pays for itself. 40 years from now, being paid in the next 5 years is not growth paying for itself. It is an excess amount of burden. And you guys normally don't do a 40-year plan on top of all that. Your planning seems to be shorter usually, and this all of a sudden became a 40-year plan. There's no sliding scale, so it doesn't factor in that, you know, new growth kicking in. So, and of all the wish lists, have all factors like maintenance and traffic been accounted for? You had a whole agenda item today about the Florida Park traffic on Florida Park Drive. And yet, we have another phase for Holland Park that will only compound the issue. Parks make our community what it is. But let's get fully informed before making a 40-year decision that affects everyone negatively. I'd like you to remember also that in the heyday, Flagler County School Board wanted 16 schools in 17 years, and they started with an astronomical impact fee that was initially, and what it is today, scaled back to its current rate. Because of a 17-year plan, there would have been a new burden placed on all new homes built, as well as the existing residents, and schools that would have been almost empty because the growth expected didn't happen. Please just get all the information and ask the right questions before making this 40-year decision. Thank you.
For comments. Next speaker.
Yes, I sat in the right spot. My name is Anna Maria Abad. I'm the executive officer at the Flagler Home Builders Association. I'm also a resident of 28 years and a mother who utilizes our parks. So I do want to preface that. But I do ask that you revisit the master plan. All the numbers that we're looking at in the impact fee increase, all the answers we got back from city staff was master plan, master plan, master plan. So let's go back, because earlier it was that there was 38 residents and some small special interest groups. That does not make up compost that were involved in creating or revisiting that plan. I believe the Pompos Communication Department has really effective ways of collecting data through Pompos Connect, through email, through social media, just having friends all over the nation. I've had friends comment, wow, your city is doing like the Mayor's 99 Challenge. That's so cool. Nobody else, our cities don't do that on social media. That's a good way to connect with residents, especially we've seen it during hurricanes and emergency services. We know that that's where our citizens look. Is that hard to create a survey? There could be a survey. Ask what we want. Because realistically, if this wasn't my job that I could come to be here, I could not come to be here. My job, another job, wouldn't say, yes, please go share your opinion. And it's important that our citizens can share their opinion, whether that be from their cell phone, the comfort of their home, in the car ride online, even the 6 p.m. meetings. What are we supposed to do with our kids? I'm a single mom. That means I have to pay someone to go watch my kids so I can tell somebody else my opinion. So it just gets convoluted in the real world of how us as citizens need to interact, and we're the ones that the parks are for. So we want to make sure everyone's voices are heard. We also saw the mailers go out and how the numbers on that, how many got returned to sender because they were vacant. So that's a waste of money. We know mailers might not be the best. Only 400 came back over 1,000. So back to the impact fee increase. While the numbers on paper are only a few hundred dollars increasing, that doesn't take into account the discount that was put on it. And so the actual dollars that are coming out of the pockets of new residents is double what they're currently being charged. The counties compared in the chart of the impact fee presentation are not truly comparable to Palm Coast. Private studies have shown only three other counties, or cities rather, that are almost identical to Palm Coast in age range, income, and size. So with that, the Home Builders Association respectfully asks that the council either revisit the master plan with more participation from the residents who will be paying for the maintenance of and using the parks, or at a minimum impose either a discount or a sliding scale for that impact fee increase.
Thank you very much. Next speaker.
Steve Carr, Palm Coast. I want to praise the city council for what they've done with Florida Park Drive as far as taking care of some of the water problems, taking care of looking at doing the beautification, and also the truck ordinance. The truck ordinance really helped the life quality of the residents, reduce the noise, reduce the vibration, reduce pollution from them. But now we're looking at another phase that we're talking about, and this is what I'd like to talk about, is on the traffic common method selected for Florida Park Drive. When you look at Florida Park Drive, Palm Coast has approximately 80,000 people. Florida Park Drive has 8,300 cars per day. That's approximately 10%. Of the volume of residents, 10%, that's quite a bit. Okay, so if you look at engineering data, striping or narrowing is the least likely, or the least will reduce the speed the least of all of the traffic comes. Same way with volume, it will reduce less than any of the other traffic calming methods. So why are we going with the least when we've done so great so far? Do we want a band-aid? Would you put a band-aid for your pinky on a gash in your arm? I don't think so. So those are just some things that we really, really need to look at. Next, if you go out to next door, you'll realize that other sections of town are taking a look at how you're handling Florida Park Drive. B section, C section, L section, S section. They're all talking about what's going on with Florida Park Drive, too. So it really makes a difference. Your streets are your arteries for the city. If they're clogged, there's a problem. And so I just ask you to reconsider what traffic calming method you will use for Florida Park Drive. Striping is least. Is that the way residents are to be looked at? Is we are the least residents to be taken care of? Just a question. Thank you.
Go next speaker.
My name is Celia Pugliese, and first of all, thank you for giving my 3 minutes, and also for everything what you've been doing until now for Florida Park Drive. I still keep hopes of whatever is left, which is the landscaping, and also the traffic calming to be used will be effective. I did write early this morning to the whole council and our mayor, a respectful email regarding the issue of Florida Park Drive and what is contemplated to do with this striping. I did include in there one of the news from the Miami area's communities. They are having the same problems that we have in Florida Park Drive, which means whether it's as per our engineer, it's a pass-through, as per the people that we don't speak with the professional wording, it's a cut-through use. They have the same problems, the speeders using their residential roads in Coral Gables and other communities, speeding, not respecting their speed limit or their signs, and creating a very hazardous situation for anybody walking, jogging, bicycling, children, adults walking their pets. They don't feel safe. So I included that article from that Miami, I think it's the Miami Herald, so you can see what they are going through already in Miami, which is way older area than our new city. So we are new here, and now is the time to address that. If those people in Miami are asking for street humps or roundabouts or some type of soft humps, like I copy the mayor and our staff, like they use in Arizona. Why do they use them in Arizona? Because 6 years ago they had this road that keeps on growing, and the only way to preserve people's lives is by those soft humps. And also, the mayor had known, I believe, driving Miami, having those ornamentals close in between sidewalks and in narrow streets and close to the curb, they act like a very good calming traffic. You can see it in Miami. We can get it here. Let's be leaders and go ahead of other people's problems to protect our quality of life. And thank you for everything you're doing and all these great ideas that we're bringing. Thank you to Max, in our administration, to Lauren, to Wayne, and to Marvin, the wonderful work they're doing. And thank you for Pampos Connect. I learned how to use it, and I'm spreading the word. It's working for me, and I hope it works for everybody. Thank you.
Next speaker. Okay, we'll close public comment. We will take your comments into consideration as we navigate through this. I appreciate you being here and actually offering your suggestions as a way to help us solve this issue. You are in the industry, and it means a lot when you do come and speak, so thanks for taking the time. And if I have any questions or anyone else, we will definitely reach out to you directly. And thank you again for this information, and I will be reading it through, I'm sure, as other council members to continue to be more informed on these issues. Okay, discussion by City Council of matters not on the agenda. Councilmember Hill.
Yep.
Vice Mayor Kupas.
Yep. Just one thing in addition to listening to the business leaders in our community. One other thing that I wanted to bring up, and Councilmember Rantino can also attest to this. The sound system at the Indian Trails Sports Complex for the baseball fields is in need of improvement. So the speakers that are there are almost like non-functional at this point. So we're using a microphone to kick off the opening day ceremonies. And more concerning is that they're going to have a Little League World Series game there, and it'll be televised. You know, I'm sure it'll be on ESPN, the Ocho, or whatever, but it's going to be important that we have proper sound systems in place so that, you know, we can deliver the message that we need to. And this is the first time that they'll be having events like that at the Indian Trail Sports Complex, so I just want to make sure that we put this in our sound system.
Lauren, you're going to be addressing that?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I asked her if she could find some money, and if not, you know, we could rent speakers to cover the Little League World Series. That's a big deal when they're having it here. And then fund on the outer years to get a good sound system here. Yeah, I agree. The thing was horrible. Well, they ended up with a microphone.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Councilmember Cox.
Nothing for this meeting.
Councilmember.
Oh, not today. Not at this time.
I just have one item. Today, Governor DeSantis had declared a state of emergency for the state of Florida for the coronavirus. I wanted to
just get a better understanding of how we as a community are A, addressing it. We heard from our fire chief earlier today, but Matt as our city manager, some of this strategy surrounding it. I know we have a team we've put together. I know we're coordinating with the county. I know we're coordinating with the health department. But what are we doing as a city to, if indeed we need to react?
So currently, it's I just want to emphasize, like everyone's emphasizing, that there's a lot of panic, and we're asking people not to panic, and it's having big implications on the West Coast, where it hit first. There's economic impacts of business closures. There are sick outs of businesses. To a point earlier, some people can work from home or telecommute. Someone made a comment, and I know they made it in good spirits regarding, well, if you can tell me how, you know, someone who does a mechanical job can commute from home. So as a city, at least internally, what we're addressing right now is identifying what core functions we have as a city and how we provide and allow for those core functions to continue in the event of a significant event or a more impactful event. Those types of services would be our fire and EMS. Those services would be our water and sewer treatment. Things that absolutely, regardless of the external environment or costs, we have to continue as a community. We've begun discussing, looking at the next council meeting or workshop, having identified several communities are also now additionally preparing, maybe premature, by declaring local states of emergency or states of awareness. On the health front, we're deferring to Florida Health Department, who is by law the ones running this event. We continue to meet weekly with Jonathan Lord, the EOC director, who's also coordinating with Department of Health, with our local healthcare provider, Admin Health, whose role in this event is treatment and stabilization of patients. They don't get to determine what tests are done and who gets tested for coronavirus. So as a city, we're focusing on two things. It's the internal management and how we're going to manage personnel and make sure we're open for business and that city essential needs and functions continue on. And it's aligning with our stakeholders right now. We've taken, it's the SARS outbreak plan. Is Jerry still here? And we're modifying that as a general EOC and city response plan to look at how we would deal with a significant health emergency. We're looking at it on a sliding scale. I don't want anyone to assume that we're planning for the worst case. I mean, we are, but that we expect the worst case, I should say. And we're literally monitoring the Florida Department of Health information every day. In fact, I've begun sending that to you as of last night. You got the status report. You will continue to get that. As far as communications are going, we are making a concerted effort in alignment with the health department, with the EOC, to only push out information as of now from the Centers for Disease Control. That is the official, there's a lot of misinformation out in the world. That is the official information. Tyler has been combing along with Jonathan and others. Even some of their information is awkward. We're looking for very specific, useful bits of information that people will actually consume and be able to find helpful. We continue to stay on top of those messagings to make sure we're in alignment with the EOC and our local stakeholders. Jerry's coordinating with our local EMS and our Kristen McCabe, our doctor who's assigned to the EMS process. And we're continuing to sort of refine an action plan. As of yet, I think our mode is collect information, again, prepare for the worst, be prepared, have a plan of action, and make sure we can articulate those plans. What is our appropriate role, and how do we support other roles? Again, how do we support the health department or the EOC or larger emergency services? We've resisted on a lot of commentary to this point, just again, because we don't need to raise the panic yet. I will continue. We will continue to shed information on the Florida stats from the Florida Health Department, and we will continue to refine that plan. And I would expect, as I mentioned, we'll be bringing updates to you probably more regularly, very targeted updates in council meetings. And as we understand more how it's going to impact the state of Florida, we will update and address the community and you as a council, and letting you know what the decision points are and what decision points we need to be making. But again, we are taking it seriously and have been preparing again from a level of service standpoint to how we replace workers if we have a sick out, to what we do if schools close. We're coordinating with all these entities. I think everyone's desire in this community, whether it's the schools and the health department and us, is to try to maintain a quality of life that we all need here, and to maintain some semblance of order as we go through an event, so everyone has access to the right services. We're doing the best we can to not spread an infection, and again, that we're focusing on the important elements.
How come no one's introduced a moratorium for coronavirus?
You just did,
right? Easy, easy, easy.
Well, I will say, you know, being in the unique situation of having my daughter wear a mask everywhere she goes to not reject a vital organ that she was just gifted, masks being sold out everywhere locally, watching that happen and wondering all of the cancer patients that are required to wear masks everywhere, that has caused an interesting impact. And, you know, I'm suspect as well, even on Amazon, going, you know, do I order masks on Amazon? What do I do? So, I mean, her transplant team in Miami has been great, but however, I would caution everyone as well, there are people in need in our community equally that require that to save their life, to be able to go outside or to their doctor's appointments or to a restaurant. They have to wear a mask. So that's been an interesting scenario, going to store after store and going, wow, you know.
To your point, the information we're pushing out now, the CDC's best advice at this point, which we'll continue to share, we've all heard it, and some people are skeptical, but frequent hand washing, full 20 seconds with soap and warm water, not touching surfaces you don't need to touch, and they're not even recommending limited travel. It's hand washing, and to your point on masks, masks are counterproductive, typically, is what they're saying, for healthy individuals. It does nothing to keep the virus out. Your eyes are still exposed, you're right. So saving those vital resources for people who need them in a medical emergency, and there are elderly and people who will wind up probably needing or being asked to have those by their medical provider. So we're following the recommendations of the CDC, we're listening to the Florida Department of Health, who is working in coordination with the governor's office, and we're preparing our resources and allocations. You know, as simple as Jerry kind of mentioned it earlier, but part of that response he talked about, instead of having teams go in as we typically do for medical emergencies or evaluations, we're sending two people in at a maximum. We have to. That's the reason it's two, to limit exposure. We're asking people to contact their medical provider directly instead of driving to the ER where they risk either exposing others or getting exposed if they don't have anything. So, you know, it's trying to find the right lanes right now, the hospital's messaging, the EOC's messaging. So we're trying to keep that coordinated so people are hearing one message from all the viewpoints and understand that their apparatus in Flagler County and the city of Palm Coast particularly are doing what we can to plan and be able to address this.
Preparedness.
Just on a kind of a something we don't know a thing about, but this council is required by the city charter to meet at least one time per month. And the business of the city for setting policy is done by Sunshine groups, committees, councils, this council as well as the PLDRB. And the Attorney General has interpreted the Sunshine Law to require that in order for there to be a valid Sunshine meeting, there has to be a physical presence of a quorum. So heaven forbid this gets to that point, there could be a possibility the city would not be able to do the business of setting policies. Your city manager has indicated the important tasks of having your city staff do all the wonderful things that it does with public safety, parks and rec, public works, et cetera, but policy needs to move forward as well. So my point is this, a group of city attorneys and county attorneys have recently asked the governor for an emergency order such that if it gets to be that bad, and local governments cannot establish a physical quorum, that there be a temporary exception to the Sunshine Law, which would allow local government bodies to meet and conduct the business that they need to conduct, in these, especially in these times where there would not be necessarily a physical quorum in attendance, as, for all the reasons that we've been discussing. So that's, well, I'll let you know. I'll keep you updated. But that's the request.
We're definitely monitoring that. And yeah,
I would just like to dovetail off what Mr. Martin just said, is how important the right information is. This morning we received a notification through a Facebook comment about a home in the F section that had a Corona sign in front of it. Not only did it take my time for about an hour to track down who it needed to go to, but I also tied up Jonathan Lord for about a half hour trying to find out the information. We sent an engine company out there to try to find where the residents were and to meet with the person who generated the question. So that truck was out of service for about an hour and a half. That was just wrong information. And it has to go through the CDC or from the Florida Department of Health through Flagler or through what we're working on with Tyler here in the city to direct the information to the right place. Please don't get more information from your friends on Facebook.
So are you telling me that people put things on Facebook that aren't true?
Yeah, it's impossible.
That's shocking.
It's completely, it's like blowing a fire alarm.
And I know
it's called psyops.
I know we probably want to get going, but if I can have one more story, and I'm not trying, but just to, I think this is important to be said. So there was an article that came out in a local newspaper recently about a coronavirus patient going to admit potentially. So I got a call from the CFO. What actually happened was an elderly resident thought that they had might have hugged somebody that had just come back from Italy. They weren't sure. They weren't feeling well. So they called 911 to ask what to do. And somebody listening to a scanner started putting on Facebook that there was a coronavirus patient in the ER room at admit, which was not true. And you can imagine the amount of panic and confusion and frustration and fear that put into people. So to the point, please, if you don't know for a fact, don't feed those rumors. Don't, because it does not help our community. It doesn't help our sense of well-being. It doesn't help our ability to respond to real emergencies. So again, just that little anecdotal piece, I felt compelled to share after you said that there are official sources. We have a thing on our media. I know EOC does. I know the health does. And again, they're all unified with the same information, same reporting that's official from the State Department of Health. And the same messaging. We'll continue to keep that updated.
You know, you may want to do is have Patrick do like a live Facebook of what you just said. Maybe we can do a live Facebook of what you just said. Let's use our social media to actually benefit the accurate information getting out there. I think that would be helpful for them to understand examples. Like, this is why we're trying to drive one message and working together.
It worked very well for the hurricanes. Yeah. Certainly, you can work ahead of time before we put the wrong information out from everybody else.
If the sheriff can have his bloodhound washing its paws, we can use that to get word.
Yes.
But let it be known that we are serious about it.
Yeah.
So we're taking this very,
very serious. Thank you. Thank you for that update. Keep up the good work. Okay. Discussion by city attorney of matters not on the agenda.
Nothing, Mayor.
Discussion by city manager of matters not on the agenda.
Thank you, Mayor.
Questions?
Yeah.